It's movie award time! The glitz, the glamour, the golden nudes. The moment has finally come when the anointed scholars of the Academy uncloister themselves from their sun-soaked citadel and announce, I am become Oscar, bringer of statues. Now you and I, Wade, we have not yet joined the esteemed company of those academics. We have not tread within their hallowed halls. We only got as far as the museum. And we don't even know if in their secret conclaves, while in the depths of their debates, if they wear mortar boards with tassels or pointy cones on their heads covered in stars and moons. And we certainly don't know what names the tonsured scribes of PricewaterhouseCooper are at this very moment painting into those red envelopes in liquid gold. But we do know which craftsmen, craftswomen, and craftspeople, and above all, which people, which movies, Wade, were bestowed the honors of an Academy nomination. Let us consider the 10 movies nominated for Best Picture. Consider them, Wade. Have you? They are all at their core about one thing: division of identity and the delusion of the self. Killers of the Flower Moon and the Zone of Interest are about people working to annihilate entire populations and convincing themselves it's benefiting their families while it's actually destroying those same families. Past Lives and The Holdovers are about people facing a confrontation of their past selves with their current selves and trying to reconcile the life they imagined possible when they were young with the life they ended up in. Barbie and Poor Things are about children in women's bodies who mature both their mind and their soul to overcome the constraints and perceptions placed on them by patriarchy, and they also have to learn how to walk normally on those feet. Maestro and Anatomy of a Fall don't have much in common, but they are about people working in creative industries, wrestling with the divide between their internal life and the version of themselves that the public perceives, having same-sex affairs both with and without the knowledge of their spouses, forcing those same spouses to diminish their own creative careers to support theirs, having a big blow-up argument with their spouse in which they're accused of being hateful monsters who don't care about others, having a moment of emotional distress in which they clamp both hands on someone else's cheeks and almost kiss them but then don't. A lot of almost kissing this year.
Yeah.
And they both have dogs whose names start with Snoop. And convincing ourselves that dropping atomic bombs on two cities was not only necessary but good is one of the great American fictions. Perhaps the Academy is trying to tell us something with these nominations. Maybe they have captured the zeitgeist, are recognizing the symptoms of a nation in the throes of a crisis of identity, struggling to see itself as good, both recognizing and denying its many harms, and seemingly headed for civil war, coming to theaters April 12th. Or maybe it's the Academy's way of admitting that, despite its lofty laurels, it sometimes gets it wrong. And this is where we come in, Wade. Mm. This is our annual special episode where we share what our ballots would say if we were so fortunate as to be issued the sheepskin and matriculate into those ranks. Maybe, just maybe, on those rare occasions when we disagree with the Academy, it's not just because we're benighted ignoramuses. In fact, our opinions are probably always right. Even though my memory is shit and you keep falling asleep during movies. Yeah, that's the ticket. So here's where we say to them and to you, you awarded it wrong for 2023.
Well, I tell you, hey, everyone, welcome again to another annual edition of You Awarded It Wrong. My name is Wade.
My name is Siggy.
And here we are to discuss our two, breaking from our normal format and even our miniseries going on ongoing at the moment, to give you our view on the movies, as previously stated, of 2023. We'll be giving you the top five of each of a selected number of categories. We don't want to make you sit here for 5 hours again. So we'll just picked a few of our favorites, and we're going to discuss those momentarily. However, now I'm now paranoid about my choices, because now you've instilled that the Academy might be conveying a very, very sound message here, that now my hodgepodge of selections may seem disjointed and uncollected in comparison. So thank you for that.
Or maybe they just reflect movies you liked this year.
Yeah, maybe they just do that. They just do that.
Also possible.
And I don't know about you, Siggy, but my God, this year, once again, it's been very hard to get it down to five categories or even 10 for our best picture.
I'm not feeling there's a lot of shuffling. I will probably change my top 10 best pictures before the end of this episode, before we reach that category.
If the past couple of weeks is an indication, I will too, because I've been shuffling things around a lot. I know there is a contention about me abusing the honorable mention in past episodes, but God damn it, it's my show too.
Yeah, the number 5 and the number 10 apparently mean different things to different people if one of those people is winning.
But you just have so much love and so much passion. And, you know, I've had movies that were in my top 10 all year, and then now they got squeezed out, and that just feels wrong to me. So, you know, I can't, even though I'm the ones doing the squeezing, you know. But, you know, some things do just have to be acknowledged. And that's really what, you know, these lists aren't really to say, hey, look how smart I am. They're here to say, I was moved, and I want you to know I was moved. And this moved me. And so much moved me this year. I think, you know, this isn't as strong as like 2020 or one of these other years like that that we've had, I think. But it wasn't like a 2020. I don't remember if 2021 or 2022 was kind of lackluster. But, this movie has I have just, you know, so much great art, so much great performance, so much great craftsmanship that I could spend an eternity talking about the selections from this year.
And yet, we have a hard out today. So we are actually going to. And between your squeezing and moving, we're going to have to take a bathroom break at some point, so we can't go on all day.
So get ready for that.
We'd better
look forward to our eliminating of waste.
Yeah, and no edits. This is going. We're shitting this episode right out. So you're hearing the conversation live as it happened, folks.
You see the hives popping out on my skin right now just hearing that.
we're exactly 12 hours off from our usual recording schedule.
We're recording in the daylight.
Yeah,
for a change.
Being more of a morning person, I'm feeling much more energetic and brain awake than usual. But
so if you're wondering why we're all bright tailed and bushy eyed, that's why.
Yeah. Or if you think we should go back to recording at night, send us an email to youwatchitwrong@happypanic.net.
We like the drowsy. One person did say they liked going to sleep because we were sleep inducing. I was like, thank you, sir.
Yeah,
I guess
I missed the alpha wave version of this podcast.
So that we might disappoint one listener by being a little more energetic this time. But longtime listeners might remember that I don't get to preview Siggy's intros for the You Awarded It Wrong sessions. I hear them as you hear them. So
because I'm writing them at the last minute. That's why.
So I wanted to say you found some really great threads through all those through our selections and through my own looking at the nominee the movies that I really liked this year. I found the threads through all my selections have been a very humanist point of view, something that was taking value in both the individual internal life as well as the collective lives of all. And like those were the movies that really that I really responded to this year. I think they'll see how that's borne out. You know, whether that's well, we'll see how that bears out in our list.
I did have a feeling that collectively
I'm sensing an edit.
collected. I did have a feeling watching movies this past year that collectively we're searching for something. We're trying to find something. I felt that. I felt that.
Our nation has gone through a thing where we were encouraged and validated to be our worst selves, whether through leadership or technology advances or all these things, and it's made us less happy. And we're wondering why we're less connected, we're less fulfilled, and we're wondering why, and we're still going away from people and more toward the things that are making us feel worse. And I think this kind of renegotiation of like what really matters to us is being sought for. You're right.
Yeah. Things don't feel right. And how did we get here? How did we get to this place?
Right.
Okay. Well, shall we get started?
Let's get started. All right. So we're going to begin with our top five performances in the Best Supporting Actor category. Let's begin with that.
Can I just preface that?
Yes.
We're going to start off just following the major categories as set by the Academy, and we're going to be light on the spoiler side for that section. Then when we get to our special categories, that's where we'll try to save our spoiler heavy elements for there. But we may sweat. So if you haven't seen these movies, proceed with caution.
Yeah, usually we want to have the climax be the best picture. That's not going to happen this time. We're going to do best picture, and then we're going to do more in depth, like our special categories that we usually do, that the Academy doesn't have afterwards. So we can be a little more freewheeling. So if you haven't seen those movies and you want to protect your spoilery, you can cut off after Best Picture, and we'll try to do our best before that.
And if by these movies we mean the 37 eligible movies I've seen, and what, how many did you see, Wade? 80-something?
87, I believe,
87.
Yes.
So that's a lot of movies you might not have seen.
Now, I slept through seven additional ones. So
you're not going to give us that list,
or
half
seen. No, okay. No. I have half seen movies are not eligible in my mind. I have to see the whole thing.
Good.
A couple of them I wish I'd slept through, but we're not going to be talking about those today. Great. Well, let's begin. So we're going to do Best Supporting Actor. Again, always a crowded category. Lots of honorable mentions that I'm going to try not to say. So here we go. Number five for me.
Okay.
And I've been waiting to say this all year. I've been dying to talk about this. Here we finally go.
Okay.
Number five, Nicolas Cage from Renfield. I'm telling you, I'm telling you, Siggy. When I heard about this movie and I heard Nicolas Cage was cast as Count Dracula, I was like, that's lazy casting. It's stunt casting. It's, let's see Nicolas Cage be crazy. I see the movie. He's not only pitch perfect, he perfectly gives the movie what it needs.
Okay.
He is my biggest thing in comedies is when the threat's not real. He is a genuine threat. He's also hilarious.
Okay.
And it contributes to, we'll talk about it, a particular thing later in the show for sure. But he gives exactly what he needs. He's in the beginning, he's doing a dead on Lugosi in the early sections of the thing. But his menace with conforming with what the script is trying to do, the script is trying to it's like a gaslighting, toxic relationship parallel.
Okay.
And just the fact that one of them is,
the therapy
an actual monster.
The trailer's about,
Right. And so, and it works so well. And, it's not a perfect movie by any stretch. But it's, he gives it exactly what it needs. And it's one of my favorite performances he's ever given. So that's my number five.
Wow. I did not see it. It did not appeal to me whatsoever. Trailer really turned me off. I don't know.
It did me too. And
I'll take
then
your
I
word
saw
for it,
it and I was like, oh yeah, it's not everyone's cup of tea. Some people love it, some people hate it. But of all things, both Nicholas Hoult and Nicolas Cage really, really, really kill it in the movie.
Okay.
My number four is what is probably the male comic performance of the year. From someone I wouldn't have but wouldn't have expected it from.
Oh, wow. Slumming, keeping comedy in the four's the ceiling for the greatest comedy performance of the year. Okay, good to know.
No. The greatest male comic performance of the year.
All right.
Is Mark Ruffalo in Poor Things.
Uh-huh.
He's
my
Duncan
number four
Wedderburn.
As well. I'll just go ahead and say.
My God, he just... Not only like Cage, perfectly encapsulates the what the movie's trying to say about how fucked up men and fucked up relationships or whatever and their expectations.
Yeah.
He is just like gut bustingly hilarious in every moment.
He is. Every gesture, every line reading is fabulous.
Every single one.
The movie really suffers when he leaves. Like you really feel the lack of his energy when he exits the picture.
And then when he comes back in at the end, you're like, yes!
Yeah. No, he's amazing. It's such a delight. And I really wanted him to be higher in my list, honestly. I kind of did the thing where if they got the Academy nomination, I erred on the side of sliding them down or out rather than forcing them in. So.
Yeah.
That helped push him down as him getting recognized otherwise.
Right, exactly. So, So best comic performances, both of us are slumming at four. Thanks for the accusation.
I didn't say it was the best.
All right. Now this role in performance I've seen compared to Ryan Gosling as Ken, who, by the way, is my number three. In that he does basically all the same things, but raunchier and with more and just with like an energy that infuses everything he's in.
Yeah.
And that's kind of true. Those two roles are kind of similar in a way.
Yeah.
Although the reason why Ryan Gosling at my number three playing Ken in Barbie, one, perfect casting. You can't. I mean, that wasn't up to him, but Gosling plays it, and I'm not just going to talk about the physical characteristics of him as Ken, but like he plays it like that. There's been a lot of performances this year that do this and do this well, and he's one of them where you've got a full human, a full personality, but it's not all entirely human because he is in this world. Like one of the most perfect moments is when he says, when she's like, he's like, I want to stay over to do what? I'm honestly not sure. Like he just, it's like, there's a need and it strips Barbie really strips away the sexuality of these characters. And instead just, you have the raw, I am here. Like, as he has said, Ken exists solely to bask in the awesomeness that is Barbie. And when Barbie's not there, it's horrendous for him, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, which is a nice parallel to what the expectation, what women are told growing up, kind of what their lives are going to supposed to be like.
He has no independent identity. Yeah, for sure.
No independent identity. It's all about worshiping the thing that is Barbie. And, Gosling's all his scene work, it's one of those things you could easily write off and say, oh, this is just silly or whatever. But I don't know if you're really paying it. I mean, not even if you're not really paying attention, he not only nails the tone of the movie perfectly, the comic sensibility of the movie perfectly. And he also, that inner pain both in the serious moments and in the hilarious moments, is so palpable. Like, I really credit the movie for sympathizing with Ken, with his plight, despite the fact that it's also true that he tried to overthrow the government. He wants to replace it. He took your house. But the movie, in a weird way, the movie kind of has a cautionary tale for a marginalized group who want to take over. And you could see the movie that way in a weird way, you know, to be like, hey, you know, it's sympathetic to his plight. And Gosling makes that so – I mean, I there's going to be no secret, you know, about my feelings about Barbie. I cried so much during Barbie. I cried for Barbie. I cried for Ken. I cried for Al. I cried for everybody. And so Gosling gets my number three.
Cool.
My number two is a recent addition. One something I could not, I realized I had snubbed and could not allow it to continue. My number two is Charles Melton from May, December as Joe Yu. There's a performance when I kept hearing about how great his performance was, and I went and saw when I saw the movie, and the movie starts out, and you're like, really? Because he's so seems like such a blank.
Yeah.
And then as the movie goes on, you're like, oh my God, this guy was born to play this role. Like, this is like his the way you. You get into his daily life of like what he wants this life to be, but also his growing, you know, questionings of like what has our life become? How did I get here?
Yeah.
And just that raw pain and both ways, the raw pain to deal with the emotion and the raw pain to like, I don't want to deal with the emotion. It's masterful, and I don't think can be under oversold.
He is great. He's on my list as well. He's amazing at playing, without stating it, like recognizing that his children have grown past the point where he was, like he's been frozen in a state since he entered this relationship with Gracie, and he's recognizing his children have grown past that point. Right. And he's like the pride with them, but like realizing like the feelings of pride he has for them, like is reflecting like of what was robbed from him. Like, you know, so he's right. Both he's so he, in a way, he's the child to them. Like the scene with him and his son on the roof where like the roles reverse.
Oh, God.
Like devastating. Right.
And that was, you devastating.
Know, and just the kid who plays his son, is so great in that scene. That whole cast is amazing. But right, just the way, really like, is. The kid recognizes, like, oh, my dad is, like, is not up to the... I can't believe how immature my dad is being right now. But not, like, in a childish way, but, like, in a sad way, right? Like,
right. How, but at the same time,
how ungrown he is.
Hold on a second. I'm not seeing any levels on the recording anymore. Oh, but I'm still getting levels here. All right. Whoo! All right. Peek behind the curtain. I hope this is going through.
Well, worst case scenario, we're having a very nice conversation.
That's true.
I feel sorry for them who miss out.
So while we stop, spoiler alert for anyone, you might want to skip ahead 30 seconds. Because I'm not going to do an honorable mention. I can't believe this scene isn't in my best scene list. Maybe it's in yours. But if it's not, but the scene...
Yeah, it is. So we can get... We can
okay,
talk about
okay,
it
we'll get to that. We'll get to that.
I know what you're going to say.
Okay. All right. Okay. Excuse me. All right. So, yeah. So that's, he's like, what a performance in an incredible movie.
Agreed.
But my number one... Melton moved out Robert Downey Jr. for Oppenheimer, okay. Who I thought was like, I could just see everything going on. He was thinking four or five steps ahead all the time, and I could see them all. It was really impressive. And he'll probably win the Oscar this year, and that's what we deserved. But
we'll
I think the main reason I... Yeah, I give a great speech. But the reason I think I kicked him out for Melton was because, I mean, his performance is good enough that it keeps me from wondering in that movie, why the fuck are we watching this confirmation hearing? It's like his confirmation hearing is the framing of the movie.
And we're gonna get to that.
I'm just going, why the fuck are we watching this?
We're gonna
get. It makes sense.
We're gonna
later,
talk about that. Yeah,
but it's enraging. Okay, all right. So, all right. So my number one, my heart. Well, this is probably my one of my favorite things of this year. My heart has always belonged since I saw it. For the best supporting actor goes to John Magaro in Past Lives as Arthur, as the husband of our lead character.
Yeah.
Again, Bryan Cranston always says award-winning parts are written, not acted, and that's a good part of this. But
well,
Magaro
that's just him being humble. That's...
Yeah, but Magaro, and I'm not taking anything away from Magaro on this because he. Just he was the reason I wanted to see the movie, honestly. And when I went to see it, the role Arthur being the person who like is he's worried, he's cautious, but he also knows what's right. And he's like, I'm not going to stand in the way. And just watching him stand on the sidelines, trying to be gracious, and knowing that this has to happen, but it's also so painful for him. Yeah. But he's not going to lash. He's not going to watch someone do the right thing and it be so hard was just so beautiful.
Well, and he's scared too, right? I mean,
yeah, he's terrified.
The moment he plays when, he hears about, I forget the old friend's name, who is coming to visit. You know, he hears about this and he's like, should I be suspicious? I'm trying not to be jealous right now. Like, are you attracted to him? What's going on? And then when he actually comes over, like they're going to go out, he meets him for the first time and sees like, oh, this is like a big strapping.
Yeah, he's like a freaking
like,
model.
You know, he plays that moment so well where, you know,
right.
Like in another movie that would like be this broad comic scene. But instead he like it's such a quiet moment of him registering like, oh, shit. Like, I didn't even think about, like, me having to compete with this guy, like, on a primal level, you know? Like, on
right,
a...
Right, right.
You know? I was dealing with this intellectually, and now I understand what the stakes actually are here in that...
yeah.
This guy's hunky on top of everything else. Yeah.
Yeah, and then he doesn't... He doesn't change his tactic. He doesn't go
right.
And like well, you gotta kick this guy out. You know? He sticks with it. And that is so beautifully admirable. It broke my heart.
Yeah.
And it's lovely.
But the way Magaro like keeps that simmering underneath the surface so that you feel it the entire time.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. It's not like a blank, like, why isn't he upset? It's like, it's there
yeah.
even though he, and it bubbles up through certain questions and certain things, but it never, it's always just simmering there. It was a perfectly measured performance. Beautiful. He'll be in my heart for a very long time.
Yeah. Okay. It's a good five. And I saw four of those performances. Okay. I'll go through my five. And just to say, we're recording this the morning before the Oscars. This is Saturday morning,
yeah.
March 9th. So we don't know who's going to win.
If
you're
do.
Really quick, you are listening to this in the same position we are. okay. So my five. My number five for Best Supporting Actor is Adrian Brody for Asteroid City.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not even a huge Adrian Brody fan. I am a big Wes Anderson fan. I've seen all of his movies. And, you know, people get put off by a lack of humanity in Wes Anderson. I don't feel that, although I understand it. I think Adrian Brody, when Wes is like being at his most formal, which he very much is in Asteroid City, like he's got his Darjeeling limited mode where he loosens up a little bit. But like Asteroid City is very formal, presentational. Within that, Adrian Brody brings the most soulful, while still like doing all the formal stuff, he finds the most soulful
yeah.
performance I've ever seen in that kind of part in a Wes Anderson movie. And
I would agree. I would agree.
And it's weird because he's kind of the Wes Anderson surrogate in a lot of ways in the script, like he's the character he's playing. But he's not, like, doing a caricature of Wes Anderson at all. He's bringing, like, something completely new and, like, a new angle into this world. And he's pulling something into this movie that doesn't exist, where he's really, like, I mean, a lot of Wes Anderson movies, and Asteroid City is particularly, like, a movie about dealing with trauma, right? And, like, what you do to deal with that. And, like, Adrian Brody, like, in just, like, a few lines, like, embodies, like, all of that hurt that he is carrying and trying to express through other people. And, like, what he's asking, how he's trying to get other people to this place where they can deal with it, like, on stage, but maybe in their real lives. I don't know. Like, it's very small role. But for me, it, like, packed a wallop.
Yeah.
And it's really, in a movie I really loved, it was – he's kind of like – is at the nexus of the moment of like where it all like comes together emotionally and intellectually.
Exactly.
For me. And I just thought it was a amazing performance and very, very limited opportunity. Anyway.
Very, very astutely observed. Very – absolutely. We'll be talking about this later. But, yeah, you're right. Adrian Brody gives the whole message of the movie – to you at one scene.
Yeah.
And we'll be talking about that later.
Yeah. Okay, great. My number four is Mark Ruffalo. We talked about that. I just want to say kudos to Mark for having one scene where he's fucking with a back brace on. Maybe it's a girdle, but I think it's a back brace because he's doing his standing up. And just like being shot from behind from that angle, not flattering, but like, it's just – there's something just so funny about it in that moment. You believe he's a world-class coxman, but also he looks very funny when he fucks.
Like, yeah, exactly.
He pulls both of things off at the same time.
Exactly, which is a real – yeah, funny fucking is, I think, is woefully underrepresented in awards ceremonies.
Yeah, agreed. My number three is – I'm – kind of shocked this wasn't on your list. Sterling K. Brown in American Fiction.
He was on there and he got edged out.
Yeah. And I thought I wouldn't have to think of much to say because you would have already talked about it.
Well, if you want, I can go on about it right now. He was right there on the end.
Here, I'll just say, like, nobody was, I don't want to be too superlative. He was so good at simultaneously playing someone who is an unlikable asshole and an endearingly wounded, funny person.
There's no it is so fantastic. The thing about I just think you never say take a lover. Well, I'm going to take my lover right now.
Yeah.
That's my favorite moment in the whole movie. I'm going to take a lover right now.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got so many great line readings in that movie, in American Fiction. I think my favorite, though, was when they're saying about Jeffrey Wright's character, his girlfriend says that he's a sad kind of funny. And Sterling K. Brown says, yeah, like a three-legged dog or, oh, shit, what's the second part?
That's right.
God damn it. What's the second part of that line? That's the funny part. And I thought I would have it if I started talking about it. Damn it. Edit point. See, this is, folks, this is where we usually edit and we go look it up.
Yeah, but I can't look it up because I'm recording from a car right now because my household's crazy. So
I'll come up with it.
Stop anything.
I'll come up with it later. Okay. Anyway, second half of that line, I'll go see the movie and then you'll know.
Yeah. You won't be disappointed with American Fiction. That's freaking amazing.
It's my gift from me to you. My number two is Charles Melton. I completely agree with everything you said. Like a revelatory performance. And, you know, it's my first time seeing Charles Melton. And it's one of those things where, like, I just can't imagine. Like, it's such a convincing performance that that's just who Charles Melton is to me. And I can't imagine him playing any other kind of role right now.
It's going to be hard. This is going to be Anthony Perkins for a bit.
Yeah, this is what happens this is how you get typecast, is being this good in your debut. But yeah, just like every down to the atom, a perfect performance. But my number one is the performance that moved me the most, which is John McGarrow in Past Lives.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
That was my number one. And as soon as I saw that movie, I'm like, wow, that's going to be hard to dislodge him from my number one.
Yeah, he never moved from there.
Just the depth that he brings to that. I will call out specific examples later, but just like in the example, there's several conversations he has with Greta Lee in that movie where he's so vulnerable in those moments.
Yeah.
And like, you can just feel him. He's like opening up and just like, you can feel a very deep part of him trying to connect with a very deep part of her.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
When he's lamenting that she dreams and she talks in her sleep in Korean.
We'll be talking about that scene. Yeah.
That lamentation of I'll never be able to get there.
He's doing something
which speaks to a great love. It speaks to a great love.
Yeah. Like he's not just like emotionally engaging with his fellow performer. Like he's speaking soul to soul. Like in this movie is what it felt like to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wonderful, 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 warm performance.
Yeah, I really thought I was the only guy stumping for that because I hadn't heard anyone. I mean, some things had them on short lists and things, but I never heard anyone talk about him. And I'm like, how is this?
I know.
How are people aren't going crazy over this?
Agreed.
So I'm really nice to hear.
Just the way he hugs her at the end. Spoiler
alert. Oh, yeah, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. I tried not to bring that up earlier.
Yeah.
No, he doesn't say a word. All right. Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful. I could talk about that performance all day.
He
was edged out for actor a few years ago for First Cow, so it was nice to see his. I'm glad he's here.
Yeah, and that was not a great first impression for me with him.
Well, did you see The Big Short? He's in The Big Short.
He has a big role
in The Big Short.
You think I can remember a small part from that far back? No, I can't at all.
All right.
Best Supporting Actress. That's what we're doing next.
Yeah. You want to go or you want me to go?
Well, let's give me a turn.
You go first. You go first.
All right. I'm going to squeeze in a special category here really quick. Best.
This is unprecedented, sir.
I know. Best child actor.
Oh, I think I know where you're going.
Would be Saki Nakatani as Akiko from Godzilla Minus One.
Mm.
Where how do you get like a two-year-old to, in a two-shot, like in a long two-shot, to stay on her mark and deliver her lines on cue and like go back and forth with an adult. Like, is she AI? Like, is she real? Is she special effect? What's going on? So I didn't want to bump anyone to put her in my top five, but I had to mention her. Okay.
Yeah.
Proper top five. Number five, Ruby Cruz Bottoms.
I knew it.
So she's, again, she's the heart and soul of this movie. Mm-hmm. She's the emotional core. She's the one you end up really rooting for. She lights up the screen. I mean, we have two very engaging leads, right,
in this movie. She also does that in the last second of the movie. Literally lights up the screen.
Yeah. We have two engaging leads, charismatic leads in this movie, and she steals every time she's on the screen. She's stealing the spotlight from them, and just by being
there,
she's just like glowing in this movie. She's pretty radiant. I'm at a certain age where I'm too old to develop a crush on someone as young as Ruby Cruz, but I can feel like a time tunnel opening up. And past Siggy, through time, having a crush on someone who didn't
who would not have been appropriate for young Siggy to have a crush on either. So I just
felt that tremor happened through space-time.
No, exactly.
I didn't feel that myself, but I felt a version of myself feel that. Anyway, Ruby Cruz. My number four is Jodie Foster in Naiad.
Oh. Did not see Naiad.
Yeah, it's a missable movie. I was annoyed. I disliked a lot of it so much that I was annoyed that when it got me and I actually was moved.
I've been there.
At the end. But it was Jodie Foster and John Rhys Davis that I was moved by.
Right.
I thought the Naiad character was so annoying and unlikable. I was actively rooting against her, against the Annette Bening character for the first half of the movie, and then I ended up rooting for the Jodie Foster character in the second half of the movie. She's so great. And I just forgot. I can't remember. I didn't realize how long it had been since I'd seen a Jodie Foster movie. I'm like, I just forgot what a star she is, you know?
Yeah.
And
it's not a showy
role at all. It's very small, but she's so good and just so charismatic. And she's, if you'll pardon me, she's keeping the movie afloat almost single-handedly. So she's my...
I've been in those situations where I'm watching a movie kind of cross-armed, and then I start crying, and I'm like, what? Wait, I'm into this?
My number three is Tilda Swinton in The Killer. Mm-hmm. Have you seen The Killer?
Oh, yes, I have seen The Killer. Yeah. She's great in that.
I mean, she's doing Tilda Swinton things. She's so good.
She tells a joke that I used to tell all the time as a kid.
What was the joke?
The joke about the bear, the guy hunting the bear.
Oh yeah, well I know the Gilbert Gottfried version of that.
She starts telling that joke, and I'm like, oh my god, I know that. It's like usually when people start telling jokes in movies, I don't know them, and like I'm like, oh my god, I used to tell this all the time in junior high.
Good joke. anyway, she just, I don't know. I didn't love that movie, but she.
I didn't either.
I thought her scenes were a highlight and just master. Tilda Swinton.
They were.
Just go watch those scenes. I don't need to tell you. My number two is Divine Joy Randolph.
Nice.
I was very moved by this performance. It's funny. It's heartbreaking. She may very well win an Oscar tomorrow night, so I maybe don't need to go on and on. I don't know who's the favorite.
I think she is the favorite.
I would think it's her. The holdover. She's wonderful. And my number one with the bullet, literally, is Penelope Cruz in Ferrari. Snubbed.
Oh, wow.
Snubbed by the Oscars, but a holy terror of a role. And really, like, I didn't love that movie either, and I thought she was – if I was going to recommend it, I'd say she's the reason to watch the movie. Amazing performance, and I don't know. I'm kind of out of words, so I'm going to hand it over to you.
There are those performances where I'm going to have a few of those too, where it's like, I love them so much, I don't have anything to say. It's like, it's just love.
Yeah.
What is there to say? Yeah, no, I haven't seen Ferrari either, but that's great to hear, because usually Michael Mann's female characters are the parts of the movie that you're like, ugh, what were you? Why did you write it that way? They always seem slighted, and so it's nice to hear that Penelope Cruz made a meal out of that.
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah, she's great.
My best supporting actress category was kind of thin this year. Weirdly. I struggled a lot because there was a lot of performances I liked, but there were either ones where I couldn't tell if they were best actor or best supporting, or if they were just too slight. Like most of the things I appreciate roles where it's like, that's a human person, but there's no like, there's nothing big about it,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And normally I love that, but like for some reason this time it was a kind of a detriment to me really picking somebody. But here we go. So my number five is Kathy Bates from Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret.
I didn't get to see that one.
This movie was my number one movie for a very long time, and it's just pushed out, and I'm so angry about it. I pushed it out just yesterday. I'm so angry about it because it's such a good movie. Kathy Bates, I actually don't know her ethnic background, but I'm kind of assuming she's not Jewish. And she's playing a Jewish grandmother.
Yeah, it doesn't. I wouldn't guess so.
And it might be a little bit of a miscasting just on that, but maybe it's the fact that she has a hairstyle just like my mother and looks just like my mother in this movie, dresses just like my mother. But she's effortlessly doing this role. She's not breaking a sweat. But in doing so, she's so real, and really funny. And I wanted to honor her for that because she's always been a reliable force in acting. And this movie shows that she's we really want to see her in any movie we can possibly see her in because
she's a pro. Wikipedia doesn't give her ethnic background, but she did go to Southern Methodist University.
Yeah,
which might be a clue.
That might be a clue. My number four.
And also White Station High School.
let's not drag up any, like,
great-grandfather was an Irish immigrant to New Orleans. There it is.
Right. My number four surprised me, actually, because I didn't think it would make the list, but here we are, is America Ferrara for Barbie. Now... Yeah. She's great in the movie, so I don't mean to dispel that she shouldn't be there. I think her, but I can't. At first, I thought, well, she's there because of that monologue. That's the monologue. The monologue is her's her nomination. Yeah. And the more I thought about it, the more I'm like, but she freaking nailed that monologue. That had to have been a hard thing to do, and not. You know, to the point of the monologue, it's like, I can't say any of these things lest I come off badly. Mm. And she says it all. And you can't help but ache for her. I mean, I think about it all the time when she just says, and if all of that is true for a doll representing a woman, then I don't even know. I think that all the time. It's always on my mind. Mm. And she kills it. And is deserving of any and all accolades that she gets. My number three is someone who was also in Barbie, but not for Barbie. Rita Ara in Polite Society as Lena, as the sister.
Oh yeah,
as the main character's sister.
Best part of that movie for sure.
I know you weren't a huge fan of that movie,
no.
And I was, but. You know, she presents her character never too far and never not enough. And she gives someone who is quietly or outwardly, but also, I mean, outwardly in behavior, but also inwardly dealing with her disappointment in herself for her artist career. But that's not the focus of the movie, but that's the drive for all her behavior. And then she has a moment where she says, lol, and I laughed. That deserves an award right there. If anyone can actually say text speak as a word and actually make it funny, they deserve an enormous amount of cash. So
you ever see Juno? You might want to check that one out.
Well, no. See, I meant someone actually makes you laugh. I like Juno. I actually like Juno a lot. But those things were like record scratches. This was like genuinely charming and funny. Her relationship to her sister never doesn't feel real. It never feels, nothing feels out of place, especially for when the movie goes into kind of weirder territory. She's a rock, and so she's my number three.
Her performance is trying really hard and skillfully to make you forget that it is still possible to have a career while you're married. Like, this is in the realm of possibility.
Right. Well, when your husband's taking, you know, implanting things and taking samples of your of your body tissue.
Yeah, it's just that getting married is not the problem there. That's not
right. Yeah,
it's not the part of that equation to solve.
Well, maybe not in our society, you know. But anyway, my number two, powerhouse, just unbelievable performance from Julianne Moore in May, December.
Yeah. So you put her in supporting.
Yeah, I wasn't so sure.
To me, that's
what
a co-lead.
To do there. Yeah, I felt so too. And then I went and I looked at it, and she's actually in a lot less of the movie than I thought. Hmm. So I would have assumed that was a co-lead. But when I was looking at what category she was up for, and they'd put her in supporting, and I was like, that doesn't seem right. And then I went and I looked at the actual movie, and yeah, Natalie Portman's the screen time wise. Is far higher than hers. Hmm. So I was
Academy consulted their charts and Astrolabs.
Well, it's all politics at that point, yeah. So either way, if it's actress or actors, either one, I don't care. She's amazing. the bravery to do the lisp, not even withstanding, the movie so perfectly weaves her. As like it begins almost thinking that we're going to do this sympathy for like, hey, let's get to know someone who we have maligned as a people because we don't really that doesn't conform with our expectations of what, you know, love and morality is. And so then you get in there, and then by the end you realize, oh, no, there's a hard morality here. That, no, that's just wrong. He had no agency to at all for this relationship. And what's so amazing is someone who is begins like an admirable, sympathetic, like kind of like I'm trying to have a normal life here. Reveals herself to be, almost the monster that, you know, the monster that she is.
Yeah.
And still being, relatably insecure, you know. So, like, she was amazing.
She didn't make my list. I agree, though. A fantastic performance. She was... But she makes it both funny and scary.
Yes. Like her last line is both hilarious and terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She is so good in this movie of playing someone who is not a smart person, does not come across as a smart person at all. In real life, as a school teacher, this is like not an educated person, and it shows. But... like there are all different kinds of smarts, and she's got this kind of like these animal smarts, like a fox, say,
yeah,
in the woods,
yeah,
where she's got this crafty, where she just like understands how to keep people under her thumb. Like she just like on an animal level, she understands how to control people,
right?
And how to
and that all comes from a place of terrified insecurity.
Yeah,
you know.
Mm-hmm.
The control comes from being insecure. It's amazing.
Yeah.
She does that. So I think this is my favorite Julianne Moore performance of all time.
And then the tantrum, the baking tantrum that she throws, that scene. Amazing. Right. That is.
Yeah, she's.
That didn't the, make the my makeup in the mirror, best scenes, the, but that's among them. That's one of them.
The makeup in the mirror scene and then the scene we're going to talk about later, I'm sure. Yeah. That I have to talk about. But yeah, she's my number two.
So many good scenes. Yeah.
And my number one is Divine Joy Randolph for The Holdovers.
Good. I'm glad I left the words for you. Go ahead.
I don't have many because it's one of those things where it's like, I think it's just undeniable. She's one of the realest people on the list in terms of like, you know, someone that you would meet in your real life. Her management of, you know, pain to like you know, trying to get through she's getting through her life. We know more about it. What's interesting is that people like Paul, like Paul Giamatti's character, already knows what the data of what she's gone through, mm-hmm. and just is defending her from the very beginning. So it's not like he has to come around.
Yeah.
But it's the rest of everything that he has to kind of the ingratiating of each them into who each other are, and still allowing them to like just I don't know it was a the other thing I love about the performance is that her performance, I mean, her role wasn't necessarily just to contrast to the lead character's situation.
No.
She had her own plight.
But doesn't it, not just a contrast, but she has to balance them out. I mean, so most of the movie is, you know, Paul Giamatti and Dominic Sessa, like, going head to head, and, like, they have this, like, this two-way dynamic. And then she has to, just by her performance, I mean, by the writing, but by her performance, like, she has to carry her own as, like, almost as kind of a third wheel in the plot in a way, in that she doesn't have the same. It's not like a triangle story, right?
No, like, you know, it's not like a triangle.
She's got to hold this story on her own, and she's interacting with the other characters, but she has to carry that, and like her grief has to be like a palpable presence in the room when she's there to like balance off these other two, and just that I just like there's just like it just works.
It just works.
Yeah,
it's one of the most solid performances of the year. You know, it's not showy, but she steals all our attention. You know, all our attention goes to her, and she nails it. It's a beautiful performance.
Yeah. Yeah, the movie's not a success. That's not a great performance, and it totally
exactly,
is.
Exactly. Yeah. It totally is. Quick shout out to Erica Ash in Outlaw Johnny Black, someone who in a lovely comic performance who finally made the horny woman funny again.
What? I didn't know that.
Okay.
All about horny women.
I was all about horny women being funny, you know? Yeah. but I always seemed in poor taste, or like, you know, well, this doesn't seem to be. Why is this funny? And boy, Erica Ash in that movie really, her palpable arousal was just hilarious. So she's really funny.
I gotta see that one. Being a huge Black Dynamite fan.
Yeah.
I really need to get this one into my brain.
All right, moving on. So we're now page two. All right, so now are we moving on to adaptive screenplay?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, moving on to adaptive screenplay. Okay. All right, number five for adapted screenplay is Cord Jefferson for American Fiction.
Okay.
This movie is something else. It's not at all subtle, but that's not a problem. If I had a criticism of the movie itself, or a reason why it may not be higher in my list, because it should be. It was in my top 10 for a while now. It's certainly not. It's filmed to be a bit sitcom-y in a way. It looks like a TV show. Yeah. But I honestly think that is probably there to make it, I guess, more palatable to certain audience members, to make it go down easier to me, because the points he puts out nails them. Just they're really aggressive, they're really spot on. So, you know, like Monk himself, I think the movie is designed to not come off as really angry in tone, even if in intellectually it's furious. And it's a nice balancing act, and I think the script bears that out very well. A lot of surprises, a lot of things that we thought were going to go one way and went another. I didn't expect a lot of things that happened to happen, despite the trailer kind of seeing like it was going to be pretty rote, even though it made some good points. An all-around great movie and a great screenplay. So, yeah, my number five is American Fiction.
Okay. That's on my list as well, by the way.
Okay. My number four is, I hope I can get this right, Takashi Yamakaze for Godzilla Minus One.
Okay, yeah.
I can't, I saw this movie three times in the theater.
Three times? Did you see the black and white also?
No, I missed it. I wanted to. If I hadn't seen it three times, I probably would have gone and seen it. I was completely bowled over by this movie. I could not, I think the thing that really surprised me more, again, this was one of those, the humanist movies I was referring to, the thing that really got me revved up about this movie. And much to my surprise, I was thinking about it, and I don't think I've seen any movie, that, and this is an ignorant statement, but most of the movies that I've seen regarding, post-war Japan were all about how awful the nuclear fallout was and how what a horrible thing we did to the Japanese people, which is true.
Yeah.
But what I've never seen is a movie that directly addresses Japan's culpability in the war.
Right.
And like how
that Japan was the aggressor before it was
right
before that before all that
and that not the Japanese people but the Japanese government and how the Japanese leaders of the country how they were steering their own citizenry to doom and destruction and then the consequences of war borne out.
Godzilla's a giant chicken coming home to roost in this movie.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And beautifully so, the government abandons them and says, well, we can't deal with this. You guys are going to have to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And the citizenry, beautifully states that they, our government has not valued human life, and we need to start valuing human life. And to do that, the first thing we have to do is defeat the thing they started. And we're going to have to do it. And, like, it's this beautifully rousing and gorgeous acknowledgement of who we are and what we've done and who we need to be.
Yeah, they need to find a new path. This is on my list, but also.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So I'll just go ahead and share my thoughts here,
please.
If that's okay.
Please.
Everything you said... that it's really about Japan having to move away from a culture of death towards a culture of, that's what the hero's journey is in the movie, is that he has to give up this idea that death is somehow glorious and honorable and find a way to solve problems that doesn't require that, right? That, that involves more ingenuity and creativity and life is life fostering as well. And then at the heart of it is this, surrogate family dynamic, this chaste marriage, that makes you for the first time in a Godzilla movie, not want Godzilla to show up.
Right. I love that statement.
Right?
I love it so much.
Usually you're tapping your foot waiting like, come on, let's get to it, And it was like, no, please, I just don't know. Like you're dreading Godzilla coming back because of what it's going to do to these people. And just like, I haven't seen close to every Godzilla movie, but I can't imagine another one that gets the human element this right. And so the fact that like it took... After how many decades, we have solved the, the first Godzilla movie makes you feel the suffering, very viscerally of the people, but it doesn't make you care about them between the Godzilla scenes,
Right, yeah. That's true. I don't remember a single character from the Godzilla movies that weren't Godzilla, but this one, I remember them all.
Yeah. Just the fact that it centers the humanity and still makes it a thrilling Godzilla spectacle at the same time is quite a feat of writing. So yes, I totally agree with you on this choice.
And the neighbor who curses him for not fulfilling his duty, which she doesn't need to because he's already doing that. And then as soon as she sees the baby and she's like, well, you're stupid for picking up that baby. You don't know how to hold. Don't come to me to expect that, you know, help with this. And then immediately is there holding the baby.
Yeah.
It's just so beautiful. Yeah. You know? It's really amazing.
Yep.
And great. It becomes part of their family dynamic, you know?
Yeah. Wonderful script.
It's a, it's just amazing script. It's not getting enough attention because that's something else. My number three is Tony McNamara for Poor Things. Based on the novel Poor Things, episodes from the early life of Archibald McCandless, MD, Scottish public health officer. So that was Rami Youssef's character was basically in the title here of the original. Anyway, so I don't know. Poor Things is incredible. We've talked about it earlier.
I saw it twice in the theater.
You did? Oh, wow.
It's the only movie I saw twice in the theater last year.
It's a real feat. Again, like you said, Poor Things and Barbie have a lot in common. Mm-hmm. Although Barbie has its miraculous feats somewhere else, whereas this one has this
flat feet
plot. That's just wow. The sexual awakening of a child in a adult's body, moving into agency and maturity is like I've never seen something done so well. And this director, Yorgos, I can't pronounce his last name.
Lathimos.
I've always felt a bit guilty because I respect the other movies he's made that I've seen, but I haven't really enjoyed them because they're really chilly. I found them cold. Mm. And this.
Recording.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1,
sync.
All right. Are you still recording? Yes?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I was talking to my iPad. It seems so. Okay. All right. Okay. Where was I? Oh yeah. Okay.
Yorgos Lanthimos.
Yeah, Yorgos Lanthimos. His movies always have been kind of chilly to me, kind of cold, and this one was full of warmth. And which I really appreciated. So like, but the script itself, so creative, so giving him a palette to explore the stuff visually that I don't think I've ever seen him do before. So really, really fascinating. And some of the, and I love seeing the this isn't the script, but well, it is a script. But just having Rami Youssef watch William Dafoe give gas bubble burps. Some of the best stuff I've seen. Really great. Really fantastic.
That script does an amazing job of like considering what would it mean to put a baby's brain into a sexually mature adult.
Right.
Right.
I wasn't going to go there for the spoiler, but you're exactly right. That's what I loved.
It's not firing the hormones, right? That's in the pituitary gland. That's in the brain, right? But all the hardware's there.
Right.
And so if you happen to find it, it's that's all working. It's just, you know, and that like if you didn't have your speech biology like holding you back, like your voice is fully formed and everything, like you stands to reason you would learn to talk faster than you do as a baby, right? You have the motor control, or at least have the motor, you know, like that it, you know, it just like kind of it works on a science fiction level too, of just like thinking, you know, it would be monstrous, but like you wouldn't have your body holding you back, and so maybe your brain would develop faster.
Yeah.
And it's not like, oh, what a curious thing this person is, this phenomenon is, but like it makes sense for how Bella is like a different type of person than you have ever encountered before.
Right, exactly.
It's like, you know,
which makes her
like there's this kind of logic behind it that they don't go into and don't have liberty to explain, which is makes it so much better.
Yes, it's a fascinating. It's fascinating to think about.
Yeah.
My number two is Kelly Freeman Craig for Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. Obviously based on the Judy Blume novel. I've never read the Judy Blume book.
No, neither did I.
But what Kelly Freeman Craig directed the movie as well. And she gorgeously, so wonderfully, because I, as a man who never read that book or grew up man, they make not just Margaret's coming of age and female, the experience of maturing as a female, understandable and relatable to someone like myself, but all the variances of all the other women and girls, not just her experience, but so many others and the variances of that occur between them. They're all so palpable and so understandable and so reasonable and it's really quite a feat. Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, is to a lesser extent, but still kind of there. It's shot kind of basically like American Fiction is. But it's masterfully done, like American Fiction is. It's masterfully done in the sense that it in the way it presents these huge ideals and internal battles that are hard to verbalize. We're dealing with a growing awareness of sexuality and you know, attraction to boys with armpit hair. It's such a lovely moment. We're dealing with the confusion of religion and like, why are all the adults in my world consumed with the idea of being religious or not being religious? And it's all just fighting and warring and conflict. And that's all it seems to be. And like, so what's the purpose? And then, socializing with other girls and the all that stuff. All of these things are so, clear, the conflicts are so clearly defined and so sympathetic that I thought this should be mandatory screening for all boys, not just girls. I know it's made for the girls and that's great, but it should be mandatory screening for all boys. Maybe they might have some empathy going forward, you know? So yeah, that's my number two.
Okay.
My number one,
I guess I need to see that one.
Yeah. It's really good. My number one is Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach for Barbie.
Surprise, surprise.
Surprise, surprise. I'm angry at the Greta Gerwig snub for director, very much so. But and I'll probably expect them to win the Oscar for this on here. And deservedly so, because, you know, the Barbie once again pulled out a Lego movie type feat of something that was never expected to be anything but a cash grab. And it turns out to be a masterpiece of not just visual production design, but also an artistic expression of the world in front. And I think the real brilliance of Barbie at its very core is not just, You know, the beginning of Barbie, I can totally see, from a hypothetical standpoint, I can totally see why people would watch the beginning of the movie and go, yeah, this is exactly what I fucking thought it was going to be. Just everyone saying hi, Barbie, all the time for 15 fucking minutes. And expressing their feminine statements. But, like, what I love about the screenplay is that, you know, a pro-feminist ideology is not the movie. It's the starting point for the movie. It's where the movie begins. And then we get to see not how Barbie affects the whole world, but how the real world affects Barbie. And that's the brilliance of it. That we get to see what our world does to someone who's living the life of who's living a representational life that they think is well they're living there. Sorry, let me get back to this. It's also confusing. No, it's not confusing at all. It's just I love how we're watching how our world is affecting the kind of perfect existence of someone like Barbie, which we later realize isn't all that perfect. But and I also got to give kudos to Mattel. And I know there were a lot of wars behind the scenes, but I got to give my kudos to Greta Gerwig and Margot Robbie for fighting and Mattel for acquiescing to let this movie be, you know, obviously in a way it is a commercial for Barbie, but it's also saying, look, this is all the ways that Barbie has positively affected not just the market, but girls and the world. And these are all the ways that it hasn't, that's negatively impacted them. Like they really took it for what it is rather than just what they want to sell. And so and because honestly, somebody smart realized if we just treat this as a commercial, everyone's going to see it as a commercial and they're going to hate it. Instead, it became a global phenomenon and one of the highest grossing movies of the year, if not all time. So number one with a bullet. Best adapted screenplay for me.
All right. Well, I'm going to go through mine. I'm going to try to pick up the pace. We're halfway through our third category, and we have eight to go, and you have a heart out. So,
sorry.
We need to start being a little more brief. Best adapted screenplay. My number five is Poor Things by Tony McNamara. I did love this movie. I think once it hits that brothel in Paris, the movie like really sandbags. I've seen it twice. I've tried to make that section work for me. It doesn't. I think the script runs out of gas and it stops. It loses a lot of momentum there. I like a lot of what this movie's doing, but that's holding it back. My number four is Godzilla Minus One, which we talked about. My number three is American Fiction. So many great lines. I was not looking forward to this movie from the trailer, which is all the publishing stuff, all of the assuming the gangster personality and all the jokes. It really felt like a black movie marketed for white Ann Arborites. Like it's really, and then like I was really pleasantly surprised by all the family drama, which is the part of the movie I really liked. And I thought that was all compelling. So many great lines, including the second half of the joke, which is "You're sad, kind of funny, like a three-legged dog or a guy dying on the toilet." That was the line. And then I don't know how as I was watching it, I wasn't sure how I felt about the kind of gimmick of the ending, which I won't go into. I'll go ahead and admit, like, an African-American man sat in the seat next to me, was laughing really hard through the whole thing, and at the end clapped when the credits rolled. He was the only person clapping. He might have been the only black person in the audience at my screening, and said, "Good movie. It was a good movie." So, hey, it had his stamp of approval. I don't know. I felt like super white, like sitting next to this guy and like taking my cues from whether it was okay to laugh from him laughing. That's the whitest I've felt in a long time. Number two, The Zone of Interest. Just to have a movie that's all about what they're doing to these victims and successfully make the victims absent without it feeling like a strike against it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, with the feeling like the point. I thought the construction of that was really careful and smart. And it's barely an adaptation. I think it just shares the title with the book and has nothing else in common with it. but that's Jonathan. That's Jonathan Glazer.
I mean,
number one.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, the point of the movie isn't necessarily the suffering of the victims. It's not the victim's point of view. It's the cognitive dissonance between the diluting of your sensibilities of your humanity, you know, in terms of the task before you, right? I mean, that's what it's about. It's not about, yeah. So that was, you know, very, very, it was compelling.
Yeah, and writing these is hollow people that you can still watch for 2 hours and.
Well, I don't know about that.
And, well,
sorry.
Hey, I didn't take my digs at Barbie.
I know. I was sitting here going, you know what?
Respectfully silent.
I'm in the minority for this movie. I think it's brilliantly done, but I'm the minority. But yeah, you were nicely silent. I should have been silent about this.
And my number one best adapted screenplay is Dungeons and Dragons: Honor Among Thieves by Jonathan Goldstein, John Francis Daly, and Michael Giglio.
Wow.
This movie was a romp. Fun from moment one to moment, whatever the number of the last moment was. I loved this movie. I had so much fun with this movie. And at a point when, like, the big franchises have gotten really tired and over-serious, right? They feel too bloated. Mm-hmm. They feel like they're trying to do too much. And this goes back to, you know, a quippier, fun, ensemble kind of caper that isn't trying to be fun in the way that the MCU was when it was at its most fun. Right. Mm-hmm. It finds a new voice. Like, it's not trying to call back to something, you know, that was working before. It's like it finds a completely new voice, I think, in this landscape. Makes me want to see the next Dungeons and Dragons movie immediately. Right. even like just the way the party is put together is really smart. But it's like it's clever and funny. And it really nails this tone where it feels like the kind of campaign you and your friends would come up with. You know what I mean?
Like, well, that's always been like the big problem with doing a Dungeons and Dragons movie is like it needs to feel that way and it can't. But this one kind of did.
This one does, you know? And it's like it's both you like being self-aware and like making cracks with each other, but also like building a world that you are going to take seriously enough and also like impressing yourself by how clever you can be in the moment with both, like, as a dungeon master throwing obstacles in the party's path and as the party coming up with unexpected solutions and putting your, you know, keeping the dungeon master back on his heels, like when, you know, catching mm-hmm. him off guard. Like, it really, you know, it really gives you that feeling. And yet, like, someone who has no experience or knowledge of the game at all could come in and completely enjoy this game, this movie on a surface level. And it's a lot of fun. I don't know.
Yeah,
I love
fun.
That movie. I think it's amazing job. Good job, guys.
Good job, okay. Guys.
Let's
well, you
go
roll
on
right
to
into
original
screenplay there, Ziggy.
Yeah, my number five is Dream Scenario by Christopher Borgli. I didn't totally love this movie. I liked it a lot. I think the script is doing something very smart that it's not getting credit for. It got pigeonholed as like, oh, it's a movie about cancel culture or it's about internet fame.
Yeah, which it isn't.
And I really thought that was just the mechanism for it to talk about what it was really talking about, which was privileged white men like having to deal with the fact that they're no longer like by default special in society. Just by dint of their status. This is a guy who hasn't really achieved anything, but wants to be treated like he's achieved everything.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
cannot handle it that he's not getting the attention he feels he deserves. When he does get some attention, it's not the kind of attention he wants, because now it's the attention of examination, right?
Right.
Now it's people saying, you know, like, hey, why do you
What have you done to earn this status? Why are you in our attention all the time when there's nothing remarkable about you? Or even like the fact that you're a part of a patriarchal system is actually has causing harm to people, even if you don't feel like you're an active participant in that harm. But people are feeling that, and they're expressing the harm that they're feeling as a because of these structures. And now you're like outraged that you're expected to feel guilty. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
For me, that's what the whole movie was about.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
It was that experience. So like, you know, hashtag Me Too, hashtag Black Lives Matter, written from the point of view of a white recipient, like just a white like person bobbing along in that sort of cultural stream.
Yeah,
and not
a bystander who
not engaging with it.
Yeah. A bystander who doesn't feel they're engaged, but they are by definition part of the that's their status. Yeah, exactly.
Well, and this guy, I mean, so it's he's like totally incurious about about the harm that other people are feeling, right? Like
exactly.
he's completely self-absorbed in thinking about him, his own trauma. And not willing to engage with the experiences of other people and how he directly or indirectly plays a part in it.
Yeah, that reminds me a lot
about me what the movie's about.
You've got the guilt of like, you know, I didn't push out indigenous people here in America. I didn't take their land and I didn't murder their people. But no. I am the recipient of
I'm
benefit.
Living on the land.
I'm literally living on the land. So like, why should I feel guilty about that? Well, you kind of should feel guilty. But I didn't do anything, and yeah, that disconnect of that's just, you know, the trauma is real whether you intended it or not, or whether you did.
Well, and then in parentheses, you know, and well, it's mine now.
Yeah, exactly.
It's too late. It's too late now to do anything about it. So I might as well keep it.
Right. Right.
You know, that's the right.
Right.
So, and how dare you suggest otherwise? that's the unspoken part.
Yeah, we'll be talking about this a little bit later.
My number four, my top four are all really strong. My number four is The Holdovers. Just a great script, and we've already talked about it. I won't go on. But so many. How wonderful to get a Lost Hal Ashby movie
in this day and age,
right? Just the fact that it's not it manages to not be a throwback to a 70s style of filmmaking just for aesthetic purposes. Like, it actually thematically resonates with the script. And I don't know if anything in the script says, like, I mean, it takes place in the 70s. It's, like, very self-consciously a 70s movie. In the 2020s, but you know, it's all about people connecting, you know, understanding their own past or understanding other people's pasts, and or learning how they have to move beyond their past and like forge a future. It's about people getting unstuck. So yeah. I don't know. I thought
it all
resonated.
Fantastic script.
Yeah, my number three is Asteroid City. Really hard not to have this higher. As a Wes Anderson fan, I felt like this was the movie where Wes Anderson, more than any other, is trying to tell us directly who he is as an mm-hmm. artist. Mm-hmm. Like, listen, like, you think this is all just like me being cute? Like, this is my process. Like, this is how I deal with shit. This doesn't mean like this isn't like I'm not fooling myself into think this is reality. This is something I'm constructing, but I'm doing it with an emotional intention to it.
Yes,
And so, if you want to know how to read me, please try to read me this way. While telling like a very compelling, heartbreaking story
and amusing story
and very funny. Yeah. Number two is May December. Amazing script.
I mean, I said at the top, it May December fits into the themes for the for 2023 very well. It's all about people deluding themselves. But the slow reveal of just how self-deluded and messed up these people are, and cruel and harmful that they are, is pretty great. And honestly, fun. Like, to make a movie this messed up, also this wickedly funny. And every single character is compelling. Like, is worth having their own story. It feels like a movie that would be a TV show these days. I'm really glad it is just a movie. Like, yeah. I think the structure of it is just perfect.
Right.
But the characters are so compelling that you could say, yeah, well, I would watch a season of this show because I would spend more time with every single one of these characters.
Yeah.
They're all just fully realized. And then number one is Past Lives. And for me, with it's not really competition. I think to have a premise that on paper would seem really trite. You think you've seen this before. You think you know what kind of movie this is going to be. And then it's just like the most honest, like every single second of this movie is just written from such an honest place.
Yeah.
And like every character is given full credit for making a mature, emotionally vulnerable, but honest decision, like in the moment. It's just such a grown up movie.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Right.
You know what I mean? And with these like heart aching dialogues that happen in it. I thought that was just a masterful script.
To our middle aged ears and eyes, it's such a balm to see something so honest. About love and romance and romantic relationships and committed relationships in the face of all of, like, you know, wish fulfillment romances that,
yeah,
you know, are out there right now. This really was not just impressive, but needed and yeah, miraculous, really.
Yeah.
Allow the actors all three of them to just bear themselves in such achingly real ways. Just really incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yep, wonderful script.
Okay, well, my for best original screenplay, my number five is Arthur Harari and Justine Triet for Anatomy of a Fall. I was really impressed. I was so impressed with not just the way they were able to verbalize these conflicts and these situations, how they revealed them, how they masked them, how they, you know, made them seem that they could be either or of many different things, but also to even conceive to structure the things in a way that really made you examine your own, the way you behave, the way you think, and the way you think about how the other people in your life think and behave. And then to show our effect on each other so clearly was just phenomenal. I really, it's a movie that I respect a lot, have a lot of love for, but I think the script really, really just sold that. So number four,
I had a lot more respect than love for Anatomy of a Fall.
Yeah, a lot more respect than love.
I really admired it.
Absolutely, a lot more respect than love for it. I completely agree. My number four is Sammy Birch and Alex Mechanic for May December. Just to take something so sensational and make it into something so uh, uh, so mature in how it in its focus, and yet also allowing itself to be funny in a way while not being sensationalist. Pretty miraculous, honestly.
Yeah,
but we've spoken
barely. It's barely camp, but it avoids going camp.
Yeah, I don't think it goes to camp, but it certainly makes you think about it. And like, and that's part of the brilliance of it. I'll get into that later, but that's part of the brilliance of it. We talked a lot about that screen. I'll move on now. My number three is Wes Anderson for Asteroid City. Again, surprised that it's this low. And I think for all the reasons you pointed out, I won't belabor it, but, you know, I think a lot of people I heard complain about the framing conceit, the TV within a show, within a about a play, what's within a blah, 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 blah. And I think I don't think it's not only does it work, I think it's wholly necessary to what he's building for us, what he's showing us. So we'll talk more about that later, but that's really, really masterful. My number two is Dream Scenario. I love this movie, and for many of the main reasons you already cited. I think a lot about the tough shit rule and how people get really upset about how they're not, how things shouldn't befall them. When it's like, well, it's just tough shit, man, because you here, it's just the way it is. And like, you can't erase other people. Like, yes, it is absurd that you did nothing. You did nothing to put yourself in everybody's dreams. You did nothing to make those dreams turn violent. But you cannot deny the trauma that these people are experiencing.
Right. Right.
It's real to them. It may not be real to you, but it's real to them. And I think that is such a powerful, such a critical failing in a lot of even interpersonal relationships where people think the other person is being stupid because this isn't real, but it's very real to them. And that, you know.
It's like the scene in May December.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Why are you bringing this up to me now?
And
can't we just talk about it?
Right. Exactly. And so, And so I think a lot of people say the ending it goes off the rails. I don't think so. I started to think so for a second, and then I'm like, oh no, this is exactly what would happen. And I love the last line. Last line kills me. It's
what was
fantastic.
The last line?
I wish this was real.
Ah, yeah.
When Nicolas Cage shows, just the one thing he actually wanted, the thing he ended up pushing away, is breaks my heart. Yeah, but number one, by a long shot, Celine Song for Past Lives. Absolutely.
Wow, we had a lot of overlap here.
Yeah. For all, I won't belabor it for all the reasons you said. I tried to throw my 2 cents in there so we didn't have to eat up time. But yeah, Past Lives is the dominant writing achievement of the year. Holdovers
right,
was a close second, a close sixth.
We were 4 for 5 overlap there.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Wow.
So we're going to move on now.
Good movies.
What's that? Go movies.
We had some good movies this year.
We certainly did. All right, so now we're going to start with Best Actor now. Best Actor. So here we're coming into not the final stretch, about midway point. Sorry. Number five of Best Act Performance, Male Performance of the Year, I'm going to go to Glenn Howerton for Blackberry.
Now, I didn't see that.
Now, this probably could be considered a supporting role. I don't think so. For some reason, I went the opposite of the Julianne Moore route this time. I'm putting him an actor.
Okay.
He as Jim Balsillie, the former CEO of BlackBerry, he is a raging asshole who makes a lot of horrible decisions. But what I love about it is that everything he does, I see where it comes from in him. the confident and bombastic outwardness certainly comes from a very place of insecurity and hope. Despite it being him being totally deluded in what the right process is, and to watch him get schooled by failing a sale and having the engineer come in and make the sale, oof, it was great. Glenn Howerton is an underappreciated performance of the year, I think. Probably the biggest underappreciated performance of the year. Hmm. My number four is Jeffrey Wright for American Fiction as Monk. I hate that I don't have a ton to say other than the fact that Jeffrey Wright puts in the same amazing fucking brilliant work he always does. And he should be fucking honored for that. Because he's an incredible actor who navigates this story in a way that in lesser hands could have really been mishandled. And he does not have lesser hands. My number three is Nicolas Cage for Dream Scenario. So double nominee this year. I never thought of myself as a huge Nicolas Cage fan, but when he's on it, he is on it. And Dream Scenario, if this were that were he's talked a lot about retiring soon. If that were his swan song, it would be very, very awesome. I mean, I don't want him to stop, but I think it's a performance marred with a script that is just, I mean, can combine combination with that screenplay. He's dialed in. He's hilarious. He's pathetic. He's everything it needs to be. His rant about when he has his own dream where he's attacked by himself and then gives they say you should apologize. So he does apologize and he talks about, I've had the pain too. And then he's ridiculed for apologizing, which he probably should have been. But then you can also feel the, well, I did what you wanted me to do. And it's all righteous and pathetic and warranted and unwarranted. And he kills it. My number two is Andrew Scott for All of Us Strangers. The lead performance is Adam.
That's one I really wished I had seen.
Well, I'll talk minimally about it coming up. But what Andrew Scott is able to do, what he's able to convey with very little effort is miraculous. It's genuinely a miracle what he is able to do. Also, he doesn't have he's got a nebulous context in which to support him in this movie. He you're really grounded only to him in this movie. It's the only thing you can hold on to make sure that is real. And he kills it. I won't go into more to ruin anything, but and I'll tell you that why later. And my number one performance of the year is Paul Giamatti for The Holdovers.
What's that? I would have gone to see it for Paul Mescal after Sun.
Yeah, like
draw. But
Paul Mescal really, he's quietly showing everybody why he might be the male Meryl Streep. And he continues to do that in this movie. And my number one is Paul Giamatti for The Holdovers. I mean, I've always been a Giamatti fan, and it's not like he hasn't had his venues to show this before, but like show these things before. But just the command of his character that he holds, you don't doubt him for a second. For something that is just, you know, I just keep thinking about the end of the movie where he's, spoiler alert, where he's in the office and, you know, basically gives up his established life for, it's a beautiful, again, the whole, and if all, none of that scene could have not worked if not for everything we saw before. And He's just a powerhouse. I'm going to transfer it now. He's the powerhouse. He's great. He's just incredible. So that's my top five.
Okay. Well, going into my five.
By the way, four of those characters were writers. Two of them were published and two not. And three were teachers.
Interesting. Hey, yeah. Interesting. I got a little more spread in mine. My number five is Joaquin Phoenix for Bo is Afraid.
This is
a minimal performance. He's, you know, it looks like he's barely doing anything. But for me, I'd never lost patience with it. I guess I could see how someone else would. But for me, like, he was putting something into every single one of those shots. And I mean, the world around him is externalizing all of his anxieties, but he's giving you the place to connect it all to without being, you know, externalizing it himself necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a very interior performance that really anchors this crazy this crazy movie.
Absolutely.
And it really worked for me. He does a lot with a little in that. My number four is Chris Pine for Dungeons and Dragons, Honor Among Thieves.
I was thinking about that during when your screenplay. I was like, Chris Pine's a hoot in that movie. He's really good.
He's so good. I mean, he plays a character who his only real ability is charisma. And Chris Pine plays like the most charismatic person ever in this movie. He has to play a guy who he has to both... for comic purposes, not contribute anything to to the group, and yet convince you he's an essential element of the group.
Right.
Right? You know, like there's the great scene of like, what exactly do you do? And he's like, well, I'm just kind of the guy who makes it all work. And like, he does. He is.
He is.
Right? But he's... you know, and he's done this kind of thing where he's the sidekick to the powerful woman thing in Wonder Woman. But, like, he does a new version of it here.
Right.
Like, he's not – he doesn't feel like he's retreading at all when he's being sidekicked to Michelle Rodriguez as the fighter.
A defter mind would have said, well, I'm the conductor. I conduct the orchestra. But, you know, he's not that deaf.
No. And he comes with all his ideas, and like none of them work, and it's hilarious. But if it weren't for him coming up with the thing that went wrong, it wouldn't have gone right. Like I don't know. Like he just makes it. He just holds that movie together in the center for me. My number three is Paul Giamatti, The Holdovers. My top three could no. Well, these next two could be shuffled. My number one is number one for a reason. Paul Giamatti's great. He's not going to win the Oscar. I hope he does. My number two is Koji Yakusho for Perfect Days. A very quiet performance where he gets to do a little more than Joaquin Phoenix. He gets to play a real person. More of a real person. If you ever see this movie, this is a real Wade Carney kind of performance, I think. You're gonna be into it.
I really want to see it again. And when I say again, I mean for the first time. the poor man. Again, I apologize to anyone at the AMC Burbank 16 who listened to a guy snore the entire time. The poor guy sitting next to me, two seats over, kept nudging me, going, dude, just get up and walk around. I'm so sorry.
Go someplace else.
It looked like a great movie.
It's very good. He's great in it. Really, really great. And my number one is Barry Keoghan for Saltburn.
Wow!
So it's a cliche to say that you would watch an actor read the phone book. But when people say that, they usually mean read it out loud. But I would watch Barry Keoghan read the phone book to himself.
Right.
I just think he's endlessly, like infinitely compelling on screen. this movie is a fucking wreck that I loved. I had such a fun time watching this disaster, and he is every bit of the reason why. I think he's in every scene. What a star. I don't know.
Wow, yeah.
I can't take my eyes off this guy. Just like watching him watch something else or study something else. There's something he does. I don't even know what it is. Like he might be the most human, or he might be an alien. Like I don't know. I can't even identify. You know, you read about people like when they saw Marlon Brando act for the first time, and like, what is this? Is this acting? What's going on? Like that. That's how I feel when I'm watching Barry Keoghan. Like I can't even identify what he's attempting to do.
Right.
There's just something. It feels like something entirely new to me. And so the fact that he made that movie, I was like. Like, wow, people hate this movie? I thought that movie was great. I mean, yeah, there, now that I think about it, there's other stuff in it that didn't make any sense. It didn't work, but he was so much fun. Like, I had a blast watching that. I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, Barry Keoghan.
Awesome. Yeah, I've only seen half of it because the theater I was in, there was a medical emergency, and we were all rushed out. So I didn't get to see all of it. The person was okay, but I think he was just drunk. But we were all rushed out, and I was like, well, all right, I'll come back again later. And I never did. But, yeah, I'll have to
Well, pick most people up. Will tell you don't bother, but...
I will bother someday. Awesome.
All right. Should we roll right into
Let's roll
best
right into
actress?
Best Actress.
Okay. My number five. Just bumping out Julianne Moore. I had to get this in here. My number five is Jennifer Lawrence for No Hard Feelings.
Wow. Hey.
I thought, what a star. What a star. This sounds so stupid and trite, but like, what a brave performance to play someone who's too old to be seen as attractive. Like, you know?
But no, you're right. That's a deceptively astute movie, actually. It is.
And she, you know, she's hilarious. Every single one of her line readings is great. But the way she plays the scene, and she makes this character like totally believable.
Yes.
It's not that great a script.
You're right. No, it's not. There's stuff going on.
She sells everything. Yeah. She sells everything that's happening. She makes you buy it. And then in the big scene of where what's his name, Dear Evan Hansen guy, is singing to her, like serenading her in the restaurant. Like, in that scene, like, damn, like, she's brought her A game. Like, like, why isn't she the hugest star? Like,
but she is, the fact isn't that she?
You know, but she should be bigger. Like, why isn't she a bigger star than she is? Like, she hasn't even been in a big movie in a while.
Yeah, this certainly
I thought she was fantastic.
Can I just interject here real quick? I'm so bummed that this fell out of my best scene category later, but I love the naked beach beatdown scene. I was blown away by that. And I mean, not just for any lascivious part, they shot it very tastefully, I think, but just that was such.
Well, there's nothing sexy about it.
There's nothing
That's
sexy
funny
about
it.
But it was just so rousing and powerful. Just that, like, yeah, here you got a helpless position, and she's and like you could see kind of his admiration of her later, or you know, because like she's like, no, I'm not going to let this stop you doing the wrong thing, and she gets up and beats these kids up.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you're not going to leave us in this precarious position. And I was like, that's fantastic. Yeah. It was so satisfying. I loved it.
Yeah, that was a great scene. Yeah, that was a laugh out loud movie. My number four is Sandra Hüller for Anatomy of a Fall.
Mm. That's my number four too.
I was, oh, great. And she's also great in the Zone of, she was the best part of
yeah, she's the best part of Zone of Interest, yeah.
So great year for Sandra, Sandra probably. She's inscrutable, right? Like in the yeah. most compelling way in this movie. And in that opening scene, I'm not sure how I was supposed to read her in that scene. Like
right.
when it comes up later that like, oh, you were trying to seduce her. Clearly you were trying to seduce this girl. I'm like, that was a seduction? Like, I was seeing that as her, like, trying to get rid of this girl.
Yeah, I saw the same way.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And maybe that's – I don't know if that's a flaw in the presentation or something, but for me it was, no. like, just part of, like, what she was bringing to the table is that you – she's really keeping you guessing and, like, keeping – holding all possibilities open while trying to read her in every scene.
Yeah.
I thought she was just like on a tightrope, like keeping, holding a line like through that whole movie. And it was fantastic.
Yeah. She does a brilliant tightrope walk of keeping you guessing to the point where I've read so many things about what they felt the outcome of the movie was that I was like, what, really? And but then they're all over the place. And I'm like, that's yeah. perfect because that's the whole thing. You don't is yeah. So I was, yeah, she's absolutely one of the most nuanced and inscrutable performances of the year for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Number three, speaking of nuance, Natalie Portman in May, December.
Mm.
This could have been my number one. The layers that she brings to this, and the way she like is slowly revealing the layers to you, is so much fun to watch her to reveal it bit by bit. One of the most fun performances to like dig into as a viewer. But the way that she does things, like in the dress, the trying on dresses scene, all in one take. Her sitting next to Julianne Moore, they're watching the daughter try on dresses for graduation.
Yeah.
And this almost made my best scenes. Natalie Portman has to, in the same moment, make you believe that she is signaling to you that she despises this woman sitting next to her, but then behaving so that she will passably make the woman sitting next to her think that she agrees with her.
Right, exactly.
Right? While they're both looking at each other in the mirror, like she has no angle at which she
yeah.
can hide her reaction
yeah, hide.
From Julianne Moore's Gracie, right?
Yeah.
So there's no aside or anything. She's completely exposed, but she has to, in her eyes, let you know without letting her know while she's
right.
looking into her eyes what she thinks of Gracie.
There is a Tatiana Maslany level of skill, like just that I haven't seen in someone other than Tatiana Maslany. That level of like, I'm letting you know, but I can't let this person know, and it all works. I'm not winking,
yeah.
and I'm not giving
yeah.
a tell. It's, you know.
Yeah,
it's
and no
beautiful.
Edits to save you. Yeah, incredible, incredible performance with micro reactions. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
exactly.
Yeah.
But speaking of micro reactions, my number two is Greta Lee for Past Lives. Fellow Northwestern alum, I don't believe a former resident of the world famous Communications Residential College. Maybe she lived in Jones. I don't know. Anyway, our friend Sandy put it in his Letterboxd review. Like she's really good at giving the "you should kiss me now" look and the "no, you should not kiss me now" look without. With them kind of looking like the same look.
Right. kiss me now.
But
you better not kiss me now.
it's kind of like the Sandra Hüller thing where, like, you're trying to read for the entire movie. You're trying to read, like, what her intentions are or if she even
yeah.
knows what her intentions are.
Right, right.
Right? Like, you know, what does she want? Does she know what she wants in, like, from moment to
Is
moment?
Is she even questioning
right
what
up
she
to
wants?
That.
Right?
Is she, yeah. Like,
right.
what's going on and making it all compelling and all empathetic and sympathetic.
Yes.
You're never not with her.
No, not at all.
During the movie. And then just that last, the tension she can like sustain just like by looking someone in the face and not doing anything yet.
Yeah.
No, she's so good.
Yeah.
But my number one is Emma Stone, Poor Things.
Mm-hmm.
And really the reason I went back and watched it a second time, even though there's lots of things in this movie I love, but, So she has to play a baby who's having sex. Right? And it has to be monstrous in a, like, Frankenstein's monster kind of way. But not so off-putting that you aren't always rooting for her and aren't creeped out by it. But also she has to, like, talk like a baby.
Mm-hmm. Or a baby with capability, you know?
A baby with capabilities. And if she gets this a little bit wrong, like if she's just the slightest bit off, this could ruin her career, right?
Yes,
like
totally.
Emma Stone is done. Laughing stock, you know? Like right. We'll never be able to look at her seriously again as a performer if she slips. I can't imagine a higher degree of difficulty in her performance. And every second is true. Every second is convincing. It never feels like a stunt, even though it looks like it, you know, it's impressive, like stunt work. And you like believe her, like you feel her growing and progressing through the film and becoming like a full person. But she always feels like the same person.
Yes, exactly.
You know,
she does
never
not feel
like
a different person
turned
at the
corner.
End of the movie, yeah.
No, she's just like picked up a new. She's just added on to what was there before. It's like just like adding layer by layer by layer.
Yeah, and to not only not fail, but to be the comic and dramatic performance of the year.
And she's hilarious. Yeah, her comic timing is unbelievable in this movie.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's
yep.
It is the performance of the year, hands down. Guess you know who my number one is.
Okay. All right. Cool.
So Best Actress was a very crowded category for me this year. So many people that I have snubbed, and many of you mentioned, and it makes me sad.
Yeah, Lily Gladstone suffered. She didn't. Once she gets sick, she doesn't have anything to do. She needed one more. She needed one more scene for me.
She did what she could, but the script did not help me. Well, never mind. I'm not going to get into that. Anyway.
I feel the same.
Let's do celebrations here. I will do one quick honorable mention because it's a voiceover performance. I think Hayley Stanfield in Spider-Man Across the Universe gives an award-worthy performance, vocal performance as Spider-Gwen. And I was so into her journey the whole time and in a way that I wasn't really in the first one, even though I loved the first one. But I love that the movie focused on her at the beginning and end, and it was beautiful. My number five performance of the year for Best Actress is Abby Ryder Forston for Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. This is a very young actress. And she was asked, yes, it's a Judy Blume novel, but she was asked to carry the movie of all this thematic weight that deals with huge things that people her age and people our age still process. And she carries the movie. And I struggled a lot about whether to put other actresses in the slot, you know, Juliette Binoche and a bunch of others. But I couldn't deny the fact, and Natalie Portman and stuff like that, but I could not deny that she was given a huge task and knocked it out of the park. So that's my number five. The number four is Sandra Hüller for Anatomy of a Fall for the same reasons that we talked about earlier. I'm going to skip that by because we have more to talk about later about that. My number three is Margot Robbie for Barbie. I don't think it's fully appreciated what she brings to this performance on a larger scale. And again, like Ryan Gosling playing a non-human, relatably, is and then reflecting on everything that is human and then becoming human in such a beautiful way is gorgeous. And so I think that can't be undersold.
I didn't like that movie overall, but I have nothing but praise for Margot Robbie's performance in it. I think she's great.
Yeah. And also, you know, to have a movie come in and have the actual movie's narrator comment on how beautiful she is would normally be in poor taste, but it really works. When the narrator goes, and she's like, I'm not pretty, I'm not beautiful. It's like, note to the filmmakers, if casting Margot Robbie is probably not a good idea if you're trying to make this point. My number two, which very well would have been my number one with a bullet in any other year, is spell check aggravator Kaylee Spaney. I don't know how to say her name. I'm sorry. Kaylee Spaney for Priscilla.
Yeah,
and I know this was a movie you and I both adored and then didn't at a certain point.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's not too much to say that she is kind of a revelation in that movie. She is such a beautifully, I know I said nuanced performance before, but it applies here. The way she ages from a young girl to, you know, an adult woman, and even as a young girl, she's carefully and calculatingly positioning herself and reacting to things, but yet also you can't not deny that her excitement at being, you know, sought by Elvis, even at freaking 15 years old. And it'd be a flaw in the other movie, but she's not presented as having many flaws, which isn't a bad thing because she shows what it's like to see a smart, capable, solid woman navigating this world. And I'm not going to talk too much about Priscilla, I think, later on in this show, but I just want to say I think the one thing about the script, which affects her performance in such a meaningful way, is that the movie doesn't show on screen any of the forces at work on Elvis to bring home the point that his behavior and actions are his own. The way his behavior towards Priscilla is not because, oh, all the demands that are put on him by an industry that's using him and blah, blah, blah. No, it's him. And I think that's incredibly important and a rather brave take on a much beloved icon, you know, American icon. Kaylee Spaney is just incredible in this movie.
I liked her a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. And, of course, my number one is Emma Stone, for all the reasons we pointed out. Just the comic performance of the year, the dramatic performance of the year, a career tightrope that not only succeeds but surpasses everything else. So, number one.
Awesome. Okay. Well, let's roll right into Best Director, shall we?
We shall.
Big two? Okay. Now, it's hard to... The challenge with Best Director is not just to pick your top five movies, right?
Right. So, that is tough.
Especially if you subscribe to auteur theory, but maybe we can say something interesting, but brief, in this category.
You know, in deference to your time. Okay, absolutely.
Let's see. Do you want to go first?
I'll go first. Mine. Okay. I had so many, obviously. But my number five director is Kelly Fremon Craig for Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. For some reasons I brought up earlier, she presents all these themes and all these really complex internal emotions that we all deal with in such a clear, palatable way that it's impressive beyond belief. Number four, a recent addition that I had snubbed, that I snuck in here because I can't deny it, Todd Haynes for May, December. What a...
Yeah.
Just to be so bold and so... I was so happy to hear to read that the music sting, the score that they keep playing, the music sting is from a different movie. And I was hoping it was from a Lifetime movie, but it's actually from an Oscar-winning, Oscar-nominated, like, 1973 British movie. But the fact that it's recycled is so important because the way that he's able to weave our perceptions of everything, to start with this, hey, this is going to be kind of campy, that kind of zoom in to Julianne Moore at the fridge, and then I don't think we have enough hot dogs. And then to say, oh, we're going to laugh at this. This is going to be fun and this is going to be whatever. And then to have to use the same sting, music sting, and have it mean something different every time. To be like, no, wait a second. I don't feel like this is comedic, but they're trying to tell me it's comedic. Should I not believe what I'm being told? You know, to then question what our expectations are all the time throughout the movie, through the use of music, through the use of editing, through the use of humor, and in contrast to what we're actually seeing play out in front of us, is just brilliance. It's just brilliance incarnate. My number three is Andrew High for All of Us Strangers. I think I'm saying his name right. I don't know. Andrew High is a filmmaker who his movies, the context and the things that make up the movie are usually never things that I'm interested in or have any association with. But when I see them on recommendations, I'm always blown away. Like Lean on Pete, it's like, why would I see that movie? And I see it, it's like, amazing. He's become event filmmaking for me. He's an event filmmaker director, especially after All of Us Strangers. He's made this movie that I, for one, will purposely never decide what actually are the mechanics of what I just saw. But he's crafted this experience that really makes us question, brings up questions of things that we don't ask each other and that we don't ask ourselves. And he does it so beautifully, so viscerally, and so about, you know, I've not had any experience that these people have had in this movie. But as a parent, as a lover, as a writer, as a human being on this planet, I jacked into all of it. You know, it was just in there. And it's an incredibly moving experience, the one that I wish everyone would take. My number two is Wes Anderson for Asteroid City. Now, listeners of this show know that Siggy likes to poke fun at me for hating Wes Anderson. And I keep saying I've never hated Wes Anderson, but I am extremely critical of Wes Anderson. But here I think Wes Anderson has crafted the best version of himself. Like you said, he's saying, this is how I think of stuff. This is how I process. And this is, I think, the epitome of, of the best representation of his talent and his thought process. It's a merging of his love of production design that doesn't overpower everything that he wants to say. In fact, it only enhances everything he wants to say. And so, which is usually what he's doing, but that's what all, but it's usually so, such a bravado production design that's all people can see. It's like superhero costumes. They can't see the writing going on behind them because they just see spandex and they go, it can't be smart. They just see the production design. But here, the production design is amped up higher than it's ever been. And he sells what he's trying to say. It's only there to sell what he's trying to say. And it's amazing. So now that's my number two. Yeah. And my number one is Greta Gerwig for Barbie. For reasons I've said before, this movie is a, you know, if it wasn't for one little dip in the movie, which is to me the kind of uninspired chase out of Mattel. Masterpiece. Yeah. I would say this is a masterpiece. I think it works as a kid's movie. It works as an adult's movie. It works on so many levels. It's just and it's all due to her, I think, and Margot Robbie too as well. But like, as soon as I heard that they were doing a Barbie movie with Anne Hathaway or whatever a long time ago. I was like, ugh. And then I heard Greta Gerwig was directing, and I went, I'm there. I got to know what she's doing. And she did it. So it's something I never cease enjoying talking about. I do have one suggestion that I told you I wanted. Don't let me forget to bring this up.
And I'm being quiet because I want you to still be happy talking about it.
Yeah. But you had said, I remember in your review, something that I think is accurate. You said Will Ferrell sucks all the air out of the room. I'm like, yeah. I don't dislike him, but I feel like his performance belies that he thinks he's in a less quality movie than he actually is. He's putting in a different level of performance that he would otherwise reserve for. He's not putting in a performance that he would otherwise reserve for a movie he thinks is higher quality. So, and I was just thinking, I thought the other day something, oh my God, how much better, even better, Barbie would be if instead of Will Ferrell in that role, it was Bob Odenkirk.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that have just, that would have taken that would have still had that presentational comedic sensibility, but it would have been less, the childlike antic with the stern face, with the non-childlike demeanor would, I think, been a more serviceable to those scenes.
Odenkirk is better at playing the guy who's a real guy who thinks he has to act this way.
Yes, 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 yes.
And to
yes.
present this way, right?
Yes.
You know, yeah.
Exactly. So, yeah, I just had that struck. I was like, oh, Odenkirk was in Little Women, so why couldn't it have worked? Maybe he was on the list. I don't know. But
that would have been cool. I would have liked that.
Yeah. So that's my five.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go. So mental exercise, like just trying to distill like what makes a director and to separate this from Best Picture, like assume that they're stuck with the script that they have or have limited flexibility and then look for like what they would have added that wasn't in the script necessarily, right? So my number five would be Christopher Nolan for Oppenheimer. You and I have our problems with old Chris. I think this is my favorite of his movies, second after Memento. And we'll get more into specific reasons why. But this is where Christopher doing his thing is like really singing to me for that first two-thirds of the movie. And for that last third, which I don't feel so great about, it's still very watchable, right? Like it should be boring. He still presents it if it's this compelling thing. And you have to like think about it to realize, why is it compelling again? I think he does a really great job of directing it. I think he directs the hell out of this movie. He deserves my number five. My number four is going to be Jonathan Glazer for The Zone of Interest. And really just like, if you think about camera angles, I just felt like these were the most carefully chosen camera angles other than Anatomy of a Fall, which didn't make my list. But I felt like these were such carefully selected camera angles throughout this entire movie. It really is like, you know, if you want to go to like the academic kind of analysis of a director's choices, like, you know how you're supposed to feel about these characters just from the placement of the camera in every single shot at this movie.
They almost all seem like they're out of German propaganda posters. You know, they're all like German family, you know, the wartime Nazi, like good Nazi families, you know, especially that opening shot with them by the lake or the river. I mean, it's right out of those photos.
They also look to me like they're being presented like insects, you know, like there's something, and that's the cinematography too, a lot of it, but they feel like they're in like a little, what do you call it? Like terrarium, like a little plastic dome, that they've put themselves into. And I thought that really worked. And then there's the, maybe controversial choice to shoot some scenes in night vision, which for me was like a very considered choice and a meaningful one. And we can go into it. I'm not going to take the time right now. I mean, it's an inverse of the morality of the rest of the movie. And it's like hidden. It's a hidden good that has to happen. The fact that it's whatever. For me, it was great. And like, even though it took me a while to figure out what the hell was going on, but which was kind of the magic of it. My number three is Bradley Cooper for Maestro, a movie that I loved. So we talk about movies that we admired more than we loved. This is the one I loved more than I admired, in a way. I thought like there were so many moments in this movie that just like popped for me, and Bradley's going for it. He's being super expressive with his direction, and I think he's doing something really bold in trying to like violate the rules of this kind of musical biopic, if you prefer, and very like consciously doing so. It didn't all add up into a compelling success for me about these two people, but there were so many it's a movie I'm really looking forward to watching again, just because there were so many moments I really, really enjoyed, and want to revisit. My number two is Sofia Coppola for Priscilla. I think this is, if you want to think about like where like direction adds something that isn't necessarily there. When Kaylee Spaney, that's her name, when Priscilla's taking that first phone call from Elvis, right? And she's taking this phone call, her face is in shadow, and it's shot in such a way, like somehow Sophia's camera is both allowing you to like experience with Priscilla like her thrill of getting this phone call and going through this thing, and also feeling the remove of this is wrong and should not be happening.
Right. Yes. Yes.
Right.
Right.
Like it's all like the camera doesn't move. Like there's no cuts in this scene. It's one long take, but somehow just the way it's photographed, it's kind of like Natalie Portman's performance in the scene. The camera is saying both of those things simultaneously.
Yes, exactly.
It's kind of a miraculous scene that way.
If I didn't feel like the director was completely absent in the last 20-25 minutes of that movie, she'd be on number two for my list too.
I thought just there were so many sequences like that where you're both feeling her thrill and feeling the future pain at the same time. I thought the tone of that movie was everything.
Yeah, the tone was everything. Miraculous, amazing.
Yeah. And then my number one, speaking of tone, sustained tone, my number one is Ari Aster for Beau Is Afraid.
Yeah.
Just like, let me put all of my subconscious anxieties on film for you and make you feel it too. and just going for a vibe and then just sustaining that vibe. And then, on top of it all, there's lots of acts to this movie. And getting close to the end of the movie, we're going to go to a play within a play that's going to do dark Wes Anderson, right? we're going to do Wes Anderson things too, but make it feel nightmarish. Like nothing textual about it is going to be scary, but something about this presentation and the tone of it is going to be this feels wrong and like something bad is going to happen, even though it doesn't lead to anything directly bad, like in this, you know, within the proscenium, but it feels like a problem while it's happening.
Right.
while on a surface level being very whimsical. That whole movie is for me. We'll talk more. We're not
sure
done talking about Beau Is Afraid.
Oh.
That's it. We have an hour left.
We have Best Picture left. What do you know? All right. So, yeah, do you want to head on into your top 10?
Okay. I'm going to do this quickly.
Yeah. We've talked a lot about most of these, so we can go on.
Yeah. And then we can do our specials, and then that will help color in around the edges. Okay. My number 10 is Oppenheimer. Flawed masterpiece. Very flawed masterpiece. My number 9 is Dungeons & Dragons, Honor Among Thieves. Mm-hmm. Maybe One of the most fun times I had in a movie theater last year. I'm already looking forward to the sequel. My number 8 is Anatomy of a Fall, which felt like somebody doing surgery on me in a way that elicited awe at times. My number 7 is Poor Things. Again, it's got this whole section for me that like doesn't work, but the rest of it is like fireworks. Great to see Terry Gilliam making movies again, even though he's not making movies. My number 6 is The Holdovers. Number 6 is The Holdovers, the movie on this list I most want to show my family. My number 5 is May, December, the movie I most want to watch with Seymour, but not necessarily with the kids.
Right.
Number 4 is Zone of Interest. Quite an achievement. Number 3 is Asteroid City. Actually, that's the one I should show to my family, too. Past Lives. And then number 1 is Bo is Afraid, which was the most fun time I had in a movie theater last year. And I saw it with the perfect crowd. I saw it like 4:30. There were a dozen people in the theater. It was a small room. These were all apparently dedicated Ari Aster fans. I had no idea this was a comedy going in. I was laughing my head off, laughing like, I can't believe I'm laughing at this thing. And everyone was. Like, everybody was having the same reactions to the same things. We were all vibing on it. It's a real vibe movie. This is... We had an episode on it, so I guess you can go listen to it. I don't need to belabor it. Bo was Afraid. For me, number like by far, my best movie experience of the last year.
Wow. That's a great list. All right. Well, as I said, pushed off just the other day. Are You There? Is God? Is Me? Is Margaret? That's not on my list as much as but we've got 10 other great movies here.
So, Are You There? God? Is Me? Margaret?
Yeah. My number 10 is Godzilla Minus One. That might be one of the most fun times I've had in the theater. Watching it 3 times. So fantastic. Number 9 is The Taste of Things.
I haven't seen that yet.
We might talk about it in a little bit. But it is a French movie that's just so sumptuous. It would be even higher if it wasn't for the last 20 minutes kind of drag a bit after something happened. But weirdly, everything that The Zone of Interest does that I'm critical of, The Taste of Things does, and I love it. In the sense that it's very plotless. It's just almost purely experiential. When it starts to do a plot, that's when it kind of becomes less pleasurable. But it's, you know, people call it one of the food porn movies. I don't think of it that way. It is definitely a romance, but, without a traditional romance, in it, but, or rather path of romance. And, the movie didn't make me want to eat. The movie made me want to be cooking. I was like, want to be cooking right now.
There's the slug line.
Yeah. Number 8 is Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. This was the first movie back after COVID for me, I think, and at least as a family. And, man, I freaking loved it. It bordered on being too much for me.
Yeah. For me, it was.
But what they were able to achieve among all that too much, I think, was so miraculous. We'll touch on that in a bit later. My number 7 was May, December, for all the things I said before. I want more Todd Haynes, Will Ferrell collaborations. Because Will Ferrell produced May, December.
He's got a good run as a producer.
His Gloria Sanchez Productions does it. So it's him and someone, I forget the name of the other producer he's partnered with on that, but
yeah, he's coming out looking better from the split with McKay.
Yeah, honestly, McKay's looking worse and he's looking better. My number 6 is Dream Scenario, from reasons we brought up before. Siggy said something to me once. He said, I don't know how you think about this, but I felt like I was watching a Wade Carney script. And I go, I didn't think about it that way, but I looked at him and went, yeah, no, that tracks. Not in the terms of his brilliance, just in the terms of these are all the choices you would want to make. And I'm like, yeah.
I'm glad I brought that up. I forgot I said that, but it's true. I felt like, oh, this, yeah.
These are all the choices are all based in the interests that Wade has. And I was like, oh, yeah, no, that's right. That's true.
Well, like even the, like the when it takes a turn, like when it goes to surprise you, like that's when you would have gone for the surprise. Like it, you know, it goes for the turns when you would have gone for the turns.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. Thank you. Number five is Poor Things. Again, just a wonderfully funny and impressive viewing of that movie. Number four, which had been higher until recently, is Past Lives, which, again, has taken a lot of our awards. I think my number four and my number two movies are the two movies that I've thought about the most in this year. Past Lives I've thought about so much ever since I saw it. Number three is All of Us Strangers, a recent addition, jumping really high to the top because it may be recency bias, but it was such a profound experience that it warranted that big a leap. I didn't mention Jamie Bell in this movie, who I thought was strange as a casting as a father. As an older father, but it is kind of stunt casting because it's the kid playing Billy Elliot saying things like enough of this poofy stuff, but man, he kills me in that movie. He's there's some scenes in there that don't quite surpass, but rival the Call Me By Your Name and Eighth Grade scenes of fathers, providing solace that I want to make a list of those movies. And that's a real tearjerker. It's great. Fantastic. My number two movie is Barbie. Just for all the reasons I mentioned before, you know, Barbie and Past Lives and then probably Godzilla Minus One are the three movies that I've thought about the most. They've consumed most of my mind this year. And Barbie's Lee is endlessly fascinating to think about both as a production and as a script, to my opinion.
Now I'm in suspense. I expected that to be your number one.
Yeah, I'm sure everybody did. And it probably should be. It probably should be. But I can't let go of something else. My number one picture of the year is Asteroid City.
Wow. Big upset.
I think it's not just a masterpiece. I think it's a gift to humanity. For that, I really do. I feel like it's something that is it's them saying it's okay that you haven't figured it out yet.
Yeah.
It's okay. And that's fine. For everybody who hasn't figured out what they're trying to figure out, it's okay. You just keep on doing what you're doing. It's all right.
That's the Adrian Brody line. Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah. I think for that reason, among all the other brilliance of that movie, between Tom Hanks, you know, telling Jason Schwartzman that, you know, I don't like you, but I'm going to pledge to love you as my family. And just everything. And then, you know, this thing with the school teacher and the cowboy that we would always talk about, and, you know, everything about that movie is... I don't think the kids get enough. I don't think about the kids as much, but that little the Jake Ryan role, he's so good. And little kid from eighth grade who's in that movie, he's just there. It's all just so lovely. And the alien is so. Don't even talk about the alien, Jesus. It's a real gift to humanity, I think, this movie. So I cannot. You know, I'll think about, you know, I'll play watch Barbie endlessly, but Asteroid City, I think, is the marvel that that we kind of needed. So that's my number one.
Wonderful.
So, lest you all think I hate Wes Anderson.
Well, the line you kept saying is, "Oh, this is only the one thing he can do."
Right.
You kept saying how disappointed you were you never found a new thing to do.
I was.
And Astro City's him telling you, saying, I'm still trying to figure out what I'm doing.
Right, yeah, exactly. You know? So it's really
It feels prepackaged, but it's not. I'm still figuring it out.
Right, right. Yeah. And so, I mean, for me as a person and me as my own, you know, attempt at being an artist, it's so comforting. It's solace that he's giving. And which, by the way, is my favorite word. And so, like, that's what he's providing. And it not only has changed, you know, how I view things about myself, it's changed how I feel about Wes Anderson and his past work. Like you said, it's like, you're still figuring it out. This is your process. And it's all okay. And so, yeah, so it's changed me on those levels. So,
yeah, believe it or not, this feels messy to me.
Right, exactly.
It looks tidy to you.
I mean, what is that? That's exemplified by Bryan Cranston standing there like, oh, what are you doing here? I'm not supposed to be here, am I? Okay. Like, even I get confused sometimes.
All right, good year movies. It was a good year.
And so many others I still need to see.
Well, this is where we're going to go deeper into spoiler zone. So if you're planning on seeing the favorites that we kept going on and on about, this might be where you want to hit pause and just keep this in your storage until you've seen those movies, because we're going to go into our favorite moments, our favorite sequences, our favorite scenes, and really talk very specifically. And some of those will come right at the end of the movie. So so if you're still with us, are you still with us? Okay. Here we go.
Here we go.
All right. What order do you want to do these in, Wade?
Let's go scene. Whoa, that's a good point. Should we do moment, sequence, scene? Or what do you think is the height of these three categories?
Let's end with moment. Let's okay. go like right down.
So let's build.
Does it feel climactic to me?
So do you want to go scene, sequence, moment, or do you want to go from big sequence
you know
to
what?
Smaller?
Let's not overthink it.
That's how I was saying.
Follow
let's go
your
scene.
Gut.
We'll go scene.
Okay.
All right. My best scene, and hope I'm going to try to save my honorable
five.
Mentions for things I think you're going to say.
Yeah, I did. I played that game too.
My number five best scene is Barbie breaks up with and builds up Ken from Barbie. Now, I couldn't tell which one I liked better, that scene or the Every Night is Boys Night scene of Ken stealing the dream house and fighting with himself on his love and admiration for Barbie, but also this new surgence of taking control and lashing it in her face and feeling bad about it. Just, ugh, kills me. Cry every time. But when Barbie comes, this scene could really have not worked, and maybe it didn't for some, but the scene of Ken, you know, Ryan Gosling is so funny in the scene, but yet also so genuinely having a crisis of self, you know, and he's able to do both of those things. And then, you know, Margot Robbie coming in saying, I care about you, I love you, but I'm not gonna, this isn't a relationship I want. You know, I'm going to break up with you, but build you up so that you're enough. You know, it's a beautiful scene. My number four scene is from Anatomy of a Fall. It's the argument. Now, I only saw this movie once. Was there an audio recording of this and they were playing it in trial and then we see it?
Yeah. And then we, right. Yeah,
that,
it begins and ends with just the audio.
There's a lot of wonderful sequences in Anatomy of a Fall, but that argument is so well written and so well performed. I would start to criticize it for being too well stated to be in the heat of an argument, but they state positions and raw emotions at the same interchangeably. It's a brilliant look into the strife in a relationship, and I thought so much about what was presented in that scene, It's a fantastic scene.
It's so much new information being thrown at you, too,
yeah.
in that scene. It, like, contrast it with the big argument scene from, like, Marriage Story.
Right.
Where you're just seeing things that you've been seeing build up come to a head. Like, in Anatomy of Fall, in the scene, so much new information is coming to light that you didn't know about
right.
their relationship
right.
and their background. And, like, in real time, you're trying to process, like, where do my sympathies lie? And I really don't know. Like, I can't keep up with what's happening.
She's right. He's right. She's right. He's right. He's right. He's right. She's taking that. He's taking that wrong. From what I kind of know, she's taking, you know, it's all over the place.
Yeah.
And you're trying to process how I should be thinking about it while also experiencing this very real thing going on in front of you. And so it's
yeah. And it's happening in the context of this trial, and you're trying to also register, like, what effect is this having on those proceedings and how
yes,
the jury
yes.
and the
what
judge
are the perceptions
are see
that are being taken? And, I liked her lawyer in that movie a lot, too. I thought he was a really good performance. So,
oh, yeah, he's great. I didn't like the prosecuting attorney.
Though. No, I didn't like him either. Yeah. No, a little much.
That was one bad performance in that.
My number three best scene
Rob Corddry
is
kind of guy.
Is Haesung and Arthur at the bar alone in Past Lives. When she goes to the bathroom and they're sit there alone, and you're like, you know, he's been... They keep acknowledging that they're not trying to exclude him, but they keep excluding him, Arthur, you know, by speaking in Korean. And then she goes to the bathroom, and they're just sitting there, and the camera's behind them, and you're looking at their backs. And Haesung kind of makes a gesture to, like... Thank you for whatever this, and then and Arthur's paying the bill for this happening, right? And he says, "I'm glad you came. I'm really glad you came here. It was the right thing to do." Just
yeah.
And you could take that many ways, but it's whatever it is. It's true. It was the right thing to do. My number two favorite scene of the year is Arthur from Past Lives, of Arthur and Nora in bed, when they're saying, then he starts talking about, "I'm the white American husband standing in the way of a great romance." And he's investigating to see how she's feeling about things. And what starts as what's so beautiful about it is that it's using casualness. Both the characters are using casualness to bring up very intense feelings, and then also using casualness to dismiss those intense feelings. And yet he's achingly trying to connect, but not trying to be confrontational. And the way she dismisses stuff, and because he even starts up saying, "Our relationship isn't that romantic. You know, we just met and had sex at a book retreat, and now we're a writing retreat, and now we're together. It's not all that thing." Prodding and saying, like, "How do you actually feel? How do you actually feel?" And she's trying to assuage him by dismissing, but she's not giving him much information because she may not even know what she's thinking either, you know? And so, yeah, just watching them trying to connect is just it's a wonderful, wonderful scene. My number one scene of the year. My number one scene of the year is Dracula gaslighting Renfield in his new apartment.
Okay.
it's the culmination of it's in the middle of the movie, I think. And Renfield has trying to set up boundaries and establish and kind of move away from him, and Dracula learns that he's not been doing what he's been asking him to do. Like, he's asked him to bring him a busload of cheerleaders or some nuns or some pure blood. And when he learns from some mob people that he literally had that opportunity to get a busload of cheerleaders and passed it up and just bringing him corrupted, evil, like dead mafia people blood. Like, he's bringing even the blood of bad people, which isn't as nourishing as the blood of innocence. Right. So Dracula goes to his new apartment, and he finds him inside his apartment. And then Nicholas Holt looks down and sees the welcome mat that he's put out that says, "Come on in." He's like, "Shit." And so he goes in, and Dracula's like, "Tell me, why is my dinner coming? you know, and Renfield's making a bunch of lies. But then, as it comes out, Dracula accuses him of not serving him. And when Renfield protests, Dracula does an amazing masterclass in gaslighting to basically say, you're the monster and I'm the victim. It's not me. Mm. You're the monster. Count Dracula is literally saying, you're the monster. And it's effective. It's actually working. You kind of can see his point of view. So Cage brilliantly does a comic performance. It's a hilarious scene. But he brilliantly performs it comedically, but also you can almost fall for it, you know? Because you're like, he's making a cogent argument about the vampire is being hurt and betrayed and victimized by this lowly human who's not bringing me my people to eat. You know? And you can see how people will, you know, which gets to the heart of the movie. So it's a fantastic scene. I love it so much. And that's my number one scene of the year.
All right. Well, I have two scenes from Past Lives on my list, and they're two different scenes than what you said.
Ooh.
Okay. My number five, though, is it's a little scene with a little person. It's Michelle Rodriguez going to visit her halfling husband, her ex-husband, in Dungeons & Dragons, Honor Without Thieves, which is like a little bit of Past Lives injected into injected into this action comedy. Where there's this, you know, this really quiet, heartfelt scene with an amazing cameo by Bradley Cooper. If we had a cameo category, well,
that's
he probably
right.
Would
that
have
was
won
Bradley
it.
Cooper, wasn't it? I forgot.
That was Bradley Cooper, and it breaks your heart. He breaks my heart in that scene, and it just like adds so much shading to her character. And it's just lovely. It's like, what is this doing in this scene, in this movie, you know? That's just the fact that they made room to put that in. It doesn't drive the plot at all. It has is like a tiny plot function that you could easily just do something else with. I don't know. Just like just a movie taking the time to have that quiet moment. And it's just feeling so human and kind and grown up was just like kind of a shock to me. And I haven't been able to shake it. My number four is the You Dream in Korean scene, the bedroom scene.
That's the same, that's the same thing
but,
same scene.
Oh, yeah, it is the same scene. Okay, sorry. Because there's two bedroom scenes, and so I sometimes...
Oh, yeah, it's the same. It's the one whole scene, yeah.
And I couldn't find clips online to go revisit it and jog my memory, because it's been several months. But the fact that this conversation just keeps going, it is like... That one scene is like two scenes because like you feel like you have an out of the scene and then it just keeps going and they keep talking and they keep exploring. And I really wish I could remember the scene better because at the time I was like, this scene is why it's going to get the movie wasn't even over. I'm like, this is getting a screenwriting nom from this from the scene alone. This it would qualify. Okay. Number three is the teacher and the cowboy in Asteroid City, the sticking to the lesson plan. Like, even before – for me, this is the one that is most about Wes Anderson's – like, what he's doing as an artist. Because the community has had this traumatic event with this alien. The kids are separated from their parents. They're all trying to process their trauma through art, right? They all bring something creative – where they, you know, I made the UFO, and the teacher is seemingly like not being flexible and like not giving them space. Like she's like, well, I prepared a lesson plan. I'm going to stick to my lesson plan. But she's not being rigid. She's just like, sticking to what I'd prepared is how I process this trauma. Like
that's how I
deal with it, right? You know, like I know you all want to talk about it, and I understand. I need to talk about this because that's – I just need to go back to what I had – carefully prepared. But then when the kid like brings his song with his apparently carefully rehearsed song with this band, you know, right? Which is an amazing musical moment. But then the teacher like responds spontaneously to someone else's art
You know, she's not, like, unfeeling.
Right, right.
Like, she's moved by this, and she starts spontaneously dancing. She can't help herself. And, like, you know, this is Wes saying, like, I respond, I react to things the same way you do. I don't know. Like, for me, like, that kind of summed it up.
Yeah.
For me. And I just, it's just a beautiful moment. And then it's got the camera move where the camera dollies into the teacher and the cowboy as they're realizing their attraction to each other, and then it dollies back out to the whole group. It's just so precise and lovely.
It's lovely.
Okay. My number two is the I've Been Thinking scene from May-December, the big, you know, Melton, like, becoming an open weeping wound of a human being.
I wanted this on my list so bad, but I couldn't get it on.
Devastating. And then number one is...
Because when Julianne Moore, spoiler alert, when Julianne Moore turns to her and says, when she said, why can't we talk about this if we love each other so much? And she's like trying to deflect with the, oh my God, what do you mean we don't love me? Blah, blah, blah. But when she says, no, you seduced me. And he's like, what? I've been in those conversations where suddenly the truth of a situation is flipped. It's so personal. And you're just like, what are you, what? And like how just everything falls out from your stomach. That was just so amazing. So, yeah.
Well, and she cannot hear that he is suffering.
Right. She can't hear. Yeah.
Because she has to be the victim. She has
exactly.
She cannot accept that she was culpable of any of perpetrating any harm.
Yeah.
It violates her self-image too much. And so she just can't hear it. That was an amazing scene. And then number one is the final scene of Past Lives, the waiting for the Uber. The will they, won't they, what's going to happen? Just the tension in that scene.
Yeah.
So quiet. They're just looking at each other and like, what's going to happen in the next moment? How long can we sustain this? And then she goes back and there he is on the steps. Yeah,
and she starts crying on the way back, and it's suddenly washing over her what's actually transpired this whole movie.
Yeah.
And then Arthur is there without judgment, you know? Just takes her in his arms and is like, letting her, knowing that she has to mourn the end of a relationship that she didn't mourn 20 years ago or whenever, how long ago that was.
And what did you say? Thanks for coming back to me.
Oh, I didn't even hear that.
Yeah.
Does he say,
thanks
I didn't.
Thanks for coming back to
thanks
me.
Thanks for coming
back. Yeah.
He just takes her in and's like, Except as so beautiful. Just so beautiful.
Yeah. He doesn't act like it was a given. Like, how dare you even consider going off with him? Like,
right.
He's, you know, acknowledging in that moment that she had a choice and.
Yeah.
And she made the one, she chose him. Okay. Do you have time for these next two categories?
Yeah. I if we can get done real quick.
All right. Okay.
Oh, real quick, I'm sad I didn't get to include Jason Momoa talks to corpses in Fast 10.
Oh, because it fucking was atrocious?
No, I loved it so much. It's the only part. Okay, I'll put it this way. If that scene wasn't in there, Jason Momoa's character in that god-awful movie would have been no threat. What did he do? He walked in and acted weird in every scene and left. It was like he was like, what's this? How's this guy a threat? You see that scene, you're like, oh shit, he's crazy. So that's the only scene where he came off as a threat. But also on top of that, it's fucking hilarious. I love that scene. It's the only scene that works in the whole movie.
That scene, like, that was the scene where, like, this does not belong in a Fast and Furious movie. Like,
yeah, but
this
it's
is
the only
not
scene
how
that
these movies
it's the
work.
Only scene that worked. All right.
This is not what these movies do.
You
want to
do best sequence now? Or you want me to?
Let's do best sequence.
You go best sequence.
Okay. All right. I got to cut something. I have six here. God.
Wait, you
okay,
have six?
Do. I know. I thought I'd figure out which one to cut by now. Okay. Number six is Student Leaves the Interview in Anatomy of the Fall. It's when it's right before the fall. and just, you know, the student closes the door, you see Sandra Huller reflected in her window, and then all the camera moves, like, you don't know everything is so precise in this. It feels like, you know, the opening of, like, the mystery television show. It feels like, you know, episode one of Twin Peaks or something where, like, you're just giving a lot of information and you don't – you know it's going to be important later, but you don't know why it is now. And so, like, just the way it's presented is mysterious and, like, you're trying to, like, very quickly absorb as much as you can because, like, okay, all this is going to be important later. Like, why does it matter where she's standing and where he's standing and where he's going and why the dog is there? And, okay, wait, now she's leaving, right. You know, and it's, like, all to that music. It's just – it's kind of like a 20-second – I don't know, piece of clockwork or something. Just a wonderful piece of filmmaking. My number five is Priscilla dyeing her hair in Priscilla.
Another
one of the great moments of direction from Sofia Coppola.
Oh, man, I forgot about that one. Yeah, it's a fantastic scene.
Wonderful director. So Elvis tells her she would look better as dark hair, so she, you know, complies. She conforms to his desires. And the way it's shot is her hair has now become an object. Like, in this montage, it would normally be the makeover montage, and, like, it would be this fun thing, you know. It's, like, kind of, like, counter to how this would be presented in Marie Antoinette. But now her hair is now an object.
Right,
attached to her head, and it's like it's shot like an anti-commercial. It like is using the tropes of both the makeover montage and a commercial, and like managing to convey the opposite message at the same time. Brilliant work. My number three is going to be the coach robbery from Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, okay.
Honor Without Thieves, where they're using the portal. So much fun. So much stuff keeps happening. Rube Goldberg type stuff. Funny, thrilling, imaginative, everything you can want. Great special effects. Really fun. Lots of fun. They have to keep solving the same problem over and over again. Number two is going to be the lunch party in Maestro, where they're sitting outside. He's getting career advice. He's being told he should change his name. We're getting kind of like, here's all the next steps you need to do in your career to be successful. And midway through, Carey Mulligan whispers to him, "This is boring. Should we leave?" And he's like, "Yeah, let's get out of here." And they leave the scene that you would normally get, the sequence you would normally get in these biopics of like, okay, and then he did this, and then and then he did that. And they flee that very intentionally and run into another room. And now we get a ballet and says, here's how I'm going to tell you what the next thing he did. He worked on the Town, and we can tell because they're going to watch the ballet of people rehearsing on the Town. And then he's going to be in a Fantasia, be injected into on the Town. And in this ballet, I, the director, am going to communicate to you that this is when she figures out he's gay.
Mm.
I'm not going to give you the scene where she opens the door and catches him with the guy,
right,
or overhears the conversation. I'm going to express it in this on the Town ballet, and we're going to just like cut to the chase, right?
Right.
And
I know.
Like, that was like maybe my favorite choice of the year of storytelling was that moment, and just it was a great ballet. And Bradley Cooper turns out as a fantastic dancer. Who could have guessed? And then my number one is the gym rally in Oppenheimer, where they've dropped the bombs. It's Victory Over Japan Day. Cillian Murphy is giving this speech. Nolan does here what he so rarely does, which is to really engage seriously with someone's interiority of their emotions. And see them as a complete human being, where he is like realizing what he has done and what he has been a part of, what he hath wrought, what he hath brung. And he's, you know, you're seeing what he's seeing, but you're also seeing what he's feeling in the way that the room is rendered. And if the movie had ended here, I would have said masterpiece, crowning achievement of Christopher Nolan's career. He said everything he needed to say. 5 stars out of 5. And then for some reason, there's another hour to this movie. But that scene was perfect, and it was a perfect ending to a perfect movie. I really thought it was like a flawless masterpiece up to that point. Mm. And then, like, why are we still going? Well, it'll get Robert Downey Jr. an Oscar, I guess. Or maybe it's worth it for that. Anyway.
Well,
what
cool.
a scene. Okay.
Wow. All right. So my best sequences are number 5, the minefield in Sisu. If you haven't seen Sisu, you should. This was in my top 10 for a very long time as well.
I don't know how to spell Sisu.
S-I-S-U. It's okay. Basically a Norwegian John Wick, but set at the end of World War II. Basically, our main character, who doesn't speak a word until the end of the movie, has found a vein of gold, and the war is ending, and the Nazis are leaving. I think it's is it Finland or Norway? I think it's Finland.
Finland. Yeah, it's Finnish.
And he comes across Nazis leaving, and they want to take his gold. And they're killing everything on their way out. And the villain is awesome because the villain realizes, hey, we're going to get back to Germany, and Germany's going to hang us because we lost the war, and or the Allies are going to hang us. Our things are over, so we need to get out. So they see the gold as a way to get out because this old man has found it. But it turns out this old man was a John Wick type figure. And so he leads his horse into a minefield that they've lied, and the horse dies, and they come to want to get the gold, and we're sitting there going, how the hell this guy is on the ground picking up gold in a minefield, standing in front of about 30 Nazis with rifles and a tank. How is he going to get out of this? And he does. It's exciting, hilarious, and bloody as hell. It's great. A lot of Nazis explode. Let's just put it that way. It's one of those impossible situations. You go, there's no way you can get out of this. And you see how he does. It's great.
Right. Sounds like a good time.
It's a great time. Sisu is a fantastic experience. Number 4 is the final goodbye in Past Lives. Should be higher, but isn't. Sorry. The final goodbye that we've already said, her walk back, him going to arms, that all that tension is just masterful, just beautiful. My number 3 is the sequence of Augie Jones does not understand Augie's actions, where Jason Schwartzman, as the actor playing Augie, stops the scene going, I don't understand why I burned my hand. And then he exits the scene to go find the playwright, but while waiting on him, he ends up talking to Margot Robbie, who played his wife in a cut scene. And then he goes and sees the director, and the director, Adrian Brody, gives him that, the point of the movie, the whole, it's okay. It's okay that you don't understand. Just go back out there. That whole sequence is just, it's the core of the movie, and it's amazing. The number 2 sequence of the year is from The Taste of Things. It's literally the first 20 to 30 minutes of the movie. It's the preparation. It's a near wordless preparation of the movie's first meal that we see. It's just the kitchen cooking. And it is one of the most beautiful cinematic experiences I've seen all year. And it's just, I can't tell you how much I want to go back and just live in that scene. It's beautiful. There's nothing more to say. They cook a meal.
Look more fun than Gene Dielman does?
Oh, yeah. Oh, God. Night and day. Oh, my God. The fact that it's weird because it's all romantically charged, but none of it is, like, suggestive. There's no suggestive stuff in it. It's just, it's showing love and passion through effort and being exact and fulfilling this dude and, like, making something together. It's beautiful. But my number 1 sequence of the year, the out of body experience I had in the theater this year, one that just took me out and was like, I can't believe what I'm seeing. I can't. The masterful culmination is the conclusion of Spider-Man Across the Universe, where Miles and Gwen both separately come into their own, and then the reveal of their plight that's in front of them. It's just a masterful bit of direction and filmmaking of just, you know, finding out that when Miles, because I know a lot of people were upset that it was a part two, that was a cliffhanger, but I felt like I got a full movie because Miles came into his own. His arc completed. He got to the end of the movie and was like, I know who I am now. I mean, I know I'm strong enough to handle this stuff. I went to where I was like, I was rejected, and I got it, and I'm going to be strong enough to tell my mother who I really am. And when he does, and that horrifying line of like, who? I'm Spider-Man. Hmm. Who? And then you realize it's all starting to come into play, that the visual cues they've been giving you, that Gwen's not outside the window. She's in he's in a different universe. She's in a different universe. And then to be like, oh no, it's all starting to click together. And then to add to that, the threat of Uncle Aaron coming in and like, well, what's the context now? You know,
all of that,
I'm electrically charged just thinking about it. My hairs are standing up on my arms. Just the like, what's going to happen? Like leading. I hadn't felt like that since them going down the stairs in Parasite to the basement. You know, like what's down there? like I have no context of like what's going to happen, and just being led to this place. And then at the end of the movie, you have the promise of the threat of the next movie, the promise of Spider-Gwen coming into her own, and then the promise of the people from the first movie coming back. Just my favorite time being in the movies that year.
Wow. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I was exhausted and frustrated.
Well, you weren't alone. I asked Carrie what she thought about it, and she said, I hated it. I was like, what?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Similar.
Well, very quickly, because I'm going to have to go in the next 15 minutes, I think.
Okay.
Should I roll right into moment, right, or do you want it to go?
Minor. Yeah, let's do moment. Minor anticlimactic, so let me go first. Okay. I'm going to squeeze in a special category, though. Score that was both great and annoying simultaneously. The score for Poor Things by Jerskin Fendricks.
Oh, I love the score, yeah.
It's great. It's also very aggravating. But Jerskin Fendricks, I really preferred his song Jerpal Phase. Remember that one?
No.
Jerpal Phase by Jerskin Fendricks.
I don't. I wish I could go along
Jerpal
with you on
phase.
This.
Going in my brain. That joke's really for Jim. Okay. All right. Let's do best moment. I'm going first. Okay. My number five is it's in Beau's Afraid. It's when he has just killed his mother. Or no, he's about to kill his mother. He's in the process of killing his mother. And then the camera tracks over. And his therapist is just standing there watching with this huge-ass smile on his face. I don't even know what that means. I feel like I was pretty good at decoding what most of the things in that movie meant. That one I don't even know. It's just that my therapist is aware of every bad thing I do, I guess. But just the fact that he has a huge smile and like getting off on it, I don't know. I love that moment. my number four is Julia Louis-Dreyfus Can't Throw Up from You Hurt My Feelings.
This is a movie we haven't talked about. It got squeezed out of my top 10 and all the other categories. But yes, You Hurt My Feelings is great. And yeah, that's a fantastic moment.
It's very funny. But what I loved most about it is how well the joke is sold by having the garbage can out of focus in the background.
Right.
Like a lesser, like, you know, another comedy would have a cut to the garbage can or would have made sure you saw the garbage can. But no, it's just kind of lingering out of focus in the background so that you can see where she should throw up, but that she's going to throw up right, like, in between her and her sister. And then she can't do it. And it's just very funny. Julie, Julie Louise.
Yeah, both she and her sister were on my short list for both categories, yeah.
Let's see. My number three is, it's in The Holdovers, and it's just one of those grace notes that's in this movie of the mitten floating away on the river. It's one of the three kids who are also holdovers and who are going to surprise me by disappearing from the movie entirely very shortly. They're not sticking around, but one of them, like the bully kid, has taken one of his mittens and lost it, stole it. I don't know. He's lost one of his mittens. So he's down to one mitten, and he's so mad and frustrated that he takes it and he throws it in the river, which is, you know, just like a piece of writing. But the fact that the camera lingers on it and just watches it float away for like a long time, like, invites you but forces you to kind of reflect on what just happened. And it's really kind of like one of the core themes of the movie is that, like, these are people who are experiencing loss, and so what do? Their reaction is to push everyone else away that they still have.
Right.
And that's what this
– or to even suffer more, because now you got one cold hand, but I'm so angry about it because it's not a set. I'm going to have two cold hands.
Right. Adam, just lovely – moment in that movie. But number two is the it's in the scene in Dungeons and Dragons where one of Chris Pine's ideas is they have to get through some gates in front of a guard, and so there's a moment where he comes through the gate and he's singing this song and the guards start bobbing their heads along, but then the illusion, it turns out an illusion glitches out, it has a lag, and he keeps repeating the line, and then his face stretches out, which is very funny. But that's not the part. The moment is before it goes wrong, and when he comes to the gate and he says, has a huge smile on his face, and he's singing the song, and he's just being the most Chris Pine I can be in this moment. And even before you see, like, the guards are into it, and it's just like comically how much they buy into this performance. Just Chris Pine coming through the gate with this glowing shit-eating grin on his face, like knowing he's the greatest bard in the world. Just like the way he sells that second. Like, I didn't even need to see everything that came after. I was already in love with this moment of the movie. That just flashes in
that reminds me of a joke he wrote for Dick and Bush, honestly.
I think I know which one you're talking about. The joke. The guy telling the joke. Yeah.
Good joke.
Dick and Bush telling the joke to the guard. Yeah. And number one is the Snoopy balloon in Maestro.
Oh, yeah, that was pretty cool.
I love that. Such a punchline on the scene.
Yeah.
But it ties back. The Snoopy was in the vestibule. Somebody left Snoopy in the vestibule, right. Wade. Why do we leave Snoopy in the vestibule?
Right. Yeah. That was great. I just got a call from upstairs, so I'll wrap this up soon. So not to be callous, because those were great moments. My number five moment actually is from Maestro as well. It's when it's Bradley Cooper's pause after Jamie says that she's relieved to hear that the rumors aren't true.
Yeah.
Where he's just sitting there. Suddenly it's washing over him how much he's lying. And he's going, I should just tell her. And you're just waiting and waiting and waiting. And then he just puts a cigarette in his mouth and walks off.
Yeah.
Let's go to lunch.
Well, just how devastated she, when she says, well, that's a relief.
That's a relief.
She says it's all rumors.
It's a relief that you are not who you really are.
Yeah. And he's like, oh, that's not, he wasn't expecting that. He wasn't prepared for that.
That was my favorite moment in the whole movie.
Just how that registers in his eyes.
Yeah. And it's again, it's one of those beautiful performance moments where he's not doing anything. Nothing changes. Mm-hmm.
It's all in his eyes.
And you just know it all. Yeah.
Yeah.
My number four moment is from Godzilla Minus One. It's hearing those first notes of the original Godzilla theme as he stomps into Ginza. I won't comment on it other than to say I read someone's Letterboxd review, and I wish I could cite who it was, but they said, I've done a lot of drugs in my life.
Branson Reese.
Put a lot of drugs in my body in my life, and nothing has got me as high as hearing those themes, that theme come in a theater. That was pretty great. Number three best moment is from A Haunting in Venice.
Oh, I didn't see that.
I think my favorite of the Branagh Poirot movies, honestly.
Yes.
Maybe I shouldn't tell you if you haven't seen it, because it's literally like the next to final moment of the movie.
Okay. So second
but
to the last moment.
For the listener, I will say, just say, it's on the rooftop. Poirot moves his teacup that's been set on the edge to be fully on the table.
Okay.
It's
all right.
It's a beautiful culmination to show that this experience has affected Poirot. Like, he may not believe in everything, but it's affected him. And it was a beautiful, beautiful touch.
Okay, cool.
My number two favorite moment is from Godzilla Minus One as well. It's the reaction of the room when Noriko says she's not a wife. And the whole room's like,
oh, yeah.
What?
Yeah. That was a great one.
It's a great scene. Probably the best scene in the best one. Mother was just like, what do you mean? And it charges the moment later where I always cry when the captain grabs our hero and says, why didn't you marry her when you had a chance? You know how she felt about her. It's like the passion that he has for that relationship. Yeah. Is really beautiful. Anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the number one moment of the year for me is in Barbie. When Barbie pulls up to the dream house and sees it's taken over, about to see it's been taken over by Kens. And Gloria asks, or maybe her daughter asks, I can't remember. He goes, these are all the dream houses where the Barbies live. And they ask, where do all the Kens live? And she goes, I don't know. Which I think was such a beautiful, it said so much. Like, we don't think about them, right. Even on the most basic level. So I thought that was I thought it was a comedic moment and a kind of a toss-up little joke, but I think I thought that was saying so much about what the movie was trying to convey, and that's my moment of the year.
Well, folks, this has been our moment to give you our moments of the year. We hope you've enjoyed it and followed along. If you haven't seen all those movies, you have the rest of your lives.
Yeah,
that's okay.
You have the rest of your life.
I don't think they're coming out with new ones this year and next year, so you should have time.
You won't feel that pressure.
Except for Civil War in theaters April 14th.
And maybe you want to see Madam Web over and over again. That might be a draw.
Well, thanks for joining us on this Odyssey and Adventure. We're going to let Wade go. I hope you have a great rest of the day. I feel very energetic. I'm usually desperately crawling into bed after we finish these recording sessions. So,
well, good. I'm glad that was the intent. But and I got to go pee like a racehorse. So I will.
All right.
I'm glad to be back. It's been a while since we recorded, so thank you. If you were waiting on it, thank you for your patience. If not, sorry for the burden. But it's been good to talk to you, Ziggy, as always. Let's not make it so long next time.
Good talking to you, Wade. Always a pleasure to talk with you about how everyone else awarded it wrong.